Also, we got one more sponsor. Oh, folks have known my travails with cats. And fortunately, before my second cat passed away, we knew that was coming. And I had the opportunity to feed him the best food I think he had ever had. The timing just worked out in this way. But this podcast is sponsored by Smalls. And if you're a listener of this show, you know about my cat travails. If you want to get 60% off your first order plus free shipping, head to smalls.com. Use our promo code MAJORITY for a limited time only. Smalls cat food is protein-packed recipes made with preservative-free ingredients that you'd find in your fridge. It's delivered right to your door. That's why cats.com named Smalls their best overall cat food. My cat, before he passed, loved Smalls. And now I'm just being able to introduce it to my new cat, who's like just coming out of kittenhood. But the thing that he loves is they have a like a broth that you can put on the food. They also have like all sorts of different flavors of Smalls. Like I say, it's all sort of like fresh, real food, no fillers. And you can pour on the broth, and he goes crazy. Cats have lesser hairballs. They have more balanced energy. They get a healthier weight. They get softer coats. If you're still not a believer in Smalls, Forbes ranks Smalls the best overall cat food. BuzzFeed wrote, "My cats went completely ballistic for this stuff." Matt's cat had the exact same reaction. Smalls also has a bunch of amazing treats and snacks you can add to your order. After switching to Smalls, 88% of cat owners reported overall health improvements. That's a big deal. You got a particularly picky cat? Smalls has a sampler, so your cat can try everything that Smalls has to offer. You can do it risk-free because the team at Smalls is so confident that your cat's going to love their food and their snacks. They will refund you if your cat won't eat it. What are you waiting for? Give your cat the food they deserve for a limited time only because you're a Majority Report listener. You can get 60% off your first Smalls order plus free shipping by using the code MAJORITY. That's 60% off when you head to smalls.com. Use the promo code MAJORITY. Again, promo code MAJORITY, 60% off your first order plus free shipping at smalls.com.
Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, June 26th, 2025. I am not Sam Cedar, but I am your fill-in host for today, Matt Binder. And this is the five-time award-winning The Majority Report. And while the rest of the crew is broadcasting to you live from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, Brooklyn, New York City, I am actually coming to you from the industrially ravaged shadow of Citi Field, the home of the New York Mets. Yeah, in Flushing, Queens. Folks, we got a great show for you today. Don't be fooled by me being here. Emma's not here, obviously. But Sam is here in spirit, or I should say via pre-record. Sam Cedar has interviews for you that he conducted. And then the boys, myself, Matt Leck, whoever else, Brandon Sutton will be joining us, I'm sure. And we'll take it over from there after Sam's interviews. But Sam's guests for today are Claire Odorino and BB Young, representing the Blue Bottle Independent Union, and Alex Salmon, features writer at Slate, discussing his piece, American Siberia, Donald Trump is enacting his darkest agenda in the backyard of a small Louisiana town. We'll have all of that and much, much more for you today on this beautiful Thursday. Matt Leck, are you still feeling so, there's still a skip to my step ever since the results of Tuesday night's election here in New York City. Do you feel the same way?
Yeah, it generally feels like a corner has been turned on a pretty dark period. And this is just me enjoying the moment right now. Obviously, rationally, I know that something, another shoe is going to drop and, you know, we're going to be back in, what do they call it, hell world? It feels good right now. And it feels like, you know, it's like the law of physics have been once again reinstated into the world.
Right. It feels like, you know, the dawn of a new day. I think Zoran Mamdani said something like that himself in one of his speeches. But for some people, they're not feeling so hot like we are, Matt. They don't feel like Zoran Mamdani's big win in the Democratic primary in New York City as a running as a Democratic socialist on a platform of freeze the rent, city-owned grocery stores, free bus fares. They don't feel like that's so great like we do. And one of those people is the hedge fund manager and Donald Trump backer, Bill Ackman. Now, for those of you who might not recall Bill Ackman, he was actually involved in the Democratic primary, which is sort of funny that he's coming into this now as if he's just been awoken to what's been going on. Because he was a big money spender for Andrew Cuomo's super PAC, the super PAC backing Andrew Cuomo, and along with being a Trump donor, like I mentioned. He's also well known for being the guy who can't write a tweet without turning it into a 10,000-word essay. Also the guy who
Are you verified on Twitter?
What's that?
Are you verified on Twitter from the old days? Yeah.
Yeah, I am. Well, no, I'm actually verified because of Elon Musk's punishment on me.
Oh, that's funny.
When he wanted me to stop the blocking blue checks.
My question is, because I'm not verified, do you have access to some sort of metrics of how much of this tweet did people read? Because the way that these guys write novellas and think anybody, even the people who agree with them, is scrolling to the bottom on Twitter, like, I don't think it's ever happened in the history of the app.
Right. We don't know how much people are reading. But what I do know is that in order to promote those features, the being able to write more than 280 characters, you need to be a blue check, which for most people means paying for Twitter, aka X, the everything app. And so the algorithm does promote those long extended tweets, you know, algorithmically to people's feeds in order to promote the idea of writing these long essays on Twitter. But okay. I don't think any, you know, it might get more views because it shows up in people's feeds, even though they don't want it in their feed. But I don't think people are reading it. I don't go to Twitter to read long form content.
I'm trying to think, like, drop site. I even mentioned it, like, I've read to the end of a drop site news tweet that was over long. And it was, I could tell it was the first time I'd ever done that in my entire life.
Right. Also, I don't know if people know this, but Elon Musk's Twitter sucks so much, even just like technically, that if you write one of those long tweets that extends past like the show more thing, you actually can't search anything past that show more in Twitter search. Like the tweet won't come up. So if you write the keyword that people are going to be searching, like below the fold, like below, like past the 280 character mark, right, it's just not going to show up in Twitter search because they haven't figured out the technology to do so yet.
Look, Grok is only getting exponentially better. It's going to be basically as smart as all of humanity ever pretty soon. We just need about $10 billion more of data servers. And that
the problem and
every other problem with society will be fixed.
Right. Now, speaking of, like we were saying, Bill Ackman's long tweets, you know, the guy who also defended his wife's plagiarism and in turn accidentally sort of, I don't know if unveiled the right word, but cemented in everyone's brain that she has connections to Jeffrey Epstein. this guy So he
who supported Trump in 2024. Sorry, just to add that too.
Big Trump supporter in 2024, big money donor to Trump and Cuomo. So Bill Ackman yesterday posts in the middle of the afternoon, like when you guys are doing this show yesterday, I have a great idea on NYC. I will share it as soon as I can. I was a bit depressed when I woke up this morning, but I am now optimistic. And then a couple of minutes later, he posts, we are looking into legal issues. And everyone's like, what? Is he gonna try to overturn the election? Like this fair election that just happened? Right. And then so Bill Ackman comes again a couple hours later. Legal issues concerning the potential for another candidate to run now. Now, this is obviously they want, you know, people should know that this isn't over. Mamdani goes to the general. And he's not going to be facing just one other guy in the general. There is actually a whole slate of candidates waiting for him in the general. Andrew Cuomo is technically on the ballot because he registered under a third party that he made up specifically to be in the general election ballot in case he lost. But he wasn't expecting to lose this badly. So now he's actually trying to decide whether it's even worth running. And then you have Eric Adams, who is our current mayor, the incumbent in New York City, who didn't run on the Democratic Party line, which he won on in 2021 to become mayor because he knew he would lose in the primary because he's now beholden to Trump so he could get those charges of corruption and bribery from Turkey dropped. So he's running on an independent line as well as the incumbent. And then there's the Republican candidate, the actual official Republican candidate, not to be confused with Cuomo and Eric Adams, Curtis Sliwa, who is the Guardian Angels guy, who, you know, is the red hat beret wearing guy or whatever.
With like 20 cats, right?
Yeah, he lives in a studio apartment with 20 cats, which is honestly the most likable thing about him. The Guardian Angels are known.
With two cats, that's too many cats.
Yeah, I guess. But apparently he helps them or whatever. But the guy goes around though, and this is what the Guardian Angels have done for decades, literally going around like as vigilantes, policing the streets without any authority. And they most notably on Fox News Air, we played it on this show, I think a year ago, saw someone who they thought was an undocumented immigrant commit what they thought was a crime, and they literally just attacked him on air. So that's the type of stuff that you'd get, I guess, if the
this
safe
work for ICE,
right? The Law and Order Republicans, of course, choosing their Republican mayoral candidate as the literal vigilante. And interesting. And then there's this other independent guy, Jim Walden or something like that, running, who's just like, I don't even know his deal. But so there are people to go with, but apparently not good enough for Bill Ackman, because early this morning, like around midnight, he drops one of his long essays about how he awoke this morning gravely concerned about New York City. I thought, what has NYC become that an avowed socialist who has supported defunding the police, whose solution to lowering food prices is city-owned supermarkets, who doesn't understand that freezing rents will only reduce the supply of housing, who has no experience in an organization, let alone a city with a $100 billion budget and a $2 trillion economy, and who believes chance for globalizing the Intifada are acceptable wins the Democratic Party. And then he goes, after speaking to those who supported Mamdani, I would love to know who the hell he spoke to, which, by the way, it actually might be his own daughter, because one of the reasons this guy got politically active is his daughter went away to college and became a Marxist.
And then, like, I think had some questions about Israel, too.
Yes, yes. He says, I believe that he won the primary largely not due to his policies. Yeah, right. But that's something we've seen from everyone.
This is Cope.
From the abundance guys to there was a whole slate of candidates. Many, maybe they didn't call themselves democratic socialists, but people who were considered progressives in New York City who did not take off whatsoever because policy was at the core. Yeah, Brad Lander. If Mamdani didn't run, Lander would have been the person that progressives coalesced around. Yeah. But Mamdani had better policies, and I guess the speaking and charisma adds to that. But the policies were at the core. I mean, people know what Mamdani's policies are about because Bill Ackman, for example, was just able to check off each and every one because that's how memorable they are. People like those policies, and they're memorable policies because they're unique and different, and people support them. So he goes, but rather because he's a superb politician who ran a remarkable and inspiring campaign. So you're wondering why Bill Ackman is now promoting Mamdani. And it's because, again, I can't read this whole thing. It's like a 10,000 word essay. But then he uses it to segue into how there are plenty of charismatic individuals out there, including people who have centrist or moderate policy ideas. And he's basically begging someone here. I'll skip down below. This is like five or six paragraphs later. The good news is that there are other charismatic, intelligent, articulate, handsome, charming, young. Wow, he really has a hard on for Mamdani. It sounds like everything but the policies. The good news is that there are other charismatic, intelligent, articulate, handsome, charming, young, yet more experienced and importantly, more centrist politicians who are New York residents eligible for office. There are also extremely talented members of the New York business community who could be superb mayors. Bloomberg being the reference standard from the past. And this setup is extremely attractive for a run for mayor. There are only 132 days until the election, which means the commitment of time to run is de minimis. So basically, he's basically saying, hey, if you want to run in this election, you don't even got to care about the people of New York enough to run a long campaign. This shit will be over in a heartbeat. Then you have to be mayor. Yeah, this will be the most closely watched mayoral election in decades, perhaps ever. Particularly in the social media and podcast. So he literally goes on to say there's all these positives of running as my candidate to stop Mamdani. But none of it involves actually serving the people of New York City. It's all about raising your own personal profile. And in return, you help me stop Mamdani. It's literally what he's saying. He continues, importantly, there are hundreds of millions of dollars of capital available to back a competitor to Mamdani that can be put together overnight. Believe me, I am in the tech strings and the WhatsApp groups. I would love to be in those WhatsApp groups and see these guys melt down.
Oh, my God.
So that a great alternative candidate won't spend any time raising funds. So he basically one unfortunate fact he adds a couple paragraphs later, as far as I understand, and this is where the legal issues from before come in, is that the candidate will have to be a write-in candidate. So
oh,
on
that's
top
gonna
of that,
be great.
He's looking to field a candidate. Again, there are four other candidates at least on the ballot whose name is not Zohran Mamdani. And he is looking to back a completely separate new candidate that can't even get ballot access in time because that ship has sailed. And he's fielding this person as a writing candidate who doesn't have to run a real campaign for a long time because A, there's not much time. B, he's got all the money in the world behind him, so don't worry about it. We'll just throw money at it. So you don't even gotta meet those smelly peons of New York City, the people who live in let's not even talk about just the people who in the Bronx and Queens and Brooklyn. You definitely won't even have to talk to those bourgeoisie in Manhattan. So it's incredible that he's doing this. It's absolutely incredible. And so this is what their plan is to stop Mamdani. Field another candidate who would run as a write-in. But I guess it's a little bit more interesting from Ackman's view is a little bit more interesting than some of the other things I've seen, such as this right-wing pundit who's been on Tucker Carlson's show, Fox News, Tim Pool's show, Nick Sartor, who has taken to social media begging Donald Trump to invoke the Communist Control Act of 1954 in order to block Zohran Mamdani from becoming mayor of New York. We have to play hardball, he said. The Department of Justice can easily establish communist ties given Mamdani openly boosted a communist group and called for a communist mayor. He should also lose his status as a naturalized citizen given he began associating with communists within 5 years of becoming a U.S. citizen. Now, the Communist Control Act of 1954 is actually still technically on the books, even though in 1973, an Arizona court ruled that the act violated the Constitution of the United States when Arizona tried to block a Communist Party USA from creating a new branch of the party in the state and run candidates in the run up to the 1972 U.S. presidential election. So this has already been shot down. An incredible Hail Mary to literally get someone removed from the ballot and the country because of their political beliefs. But also stunning all around, from the Ackmans to the Sortors, the guy I just mentioned, that like if Mamdani's going to be so bad like they think, and they hate New York so much, they tell us this all the time, why wouldn't they be joyful that Mamdani is going to destroy the city they hate and in turn ruin the reputation of progressives and leftists and democratic socialists all throughout the country? I mean, if that was if you felt so strongly about those things, then the combination of events here is the perfect scenario strategically for you to prove once and for all that you've been right all along about liberal cities, about the left, about Democrats, about socialism. This is your opportunity. This is like this is the best thing that could happen to you.
They were acting the same way after AOC won the primary in 2018, that, oh, we're going to use this to cream the Democrats in the midterms and then in the general in 2020. And Democrats did well in both of those elections.
Right. But what I think is going on here is that, unlike AOC, Mamdani actually has the power to do these things that he's saying he will do. Like, people keep saying, oh, yeah, I don't know, he can't freeze the rent. Actually, he can. He can freeze the rent. People don't even understand what he's talking about either. Like, the freeze the rent thing is all about freezing the rent of rent-stabilized apartments in New York City. And they love to bring out the idea that this isn't going to solve the housing crisis, and all Mamdani cares about is helping out recent transplants to New York City. I can tell you, as a born and raised lifelong New Yorker for over 38 years, the people living in rent-stabilized apartments are pretty hard to get in New York City. People who are in rent-stabilized apartments, once they do get it, they live there for years, not years, decades, generations.
Yeah.
They stay there. So what this would do is provide relief to lifelong, probably mostly born and raised New York working class residents. And that's the main thing here, to provide relief for them. He has other plans for a whole slew of housing policy initiatives. This is to straight up help New York's working people who've lived here for many years and just help give them relief as prices raise all across the board, really all over the country, but especially in New York City, to give them relief in just one area, the rent. And I can tell you, as a rent-stabilized resident myself, it's going to be a huge help for working families like myself, especially people with kids such as myself. This is what they fear, that Mamdani can actually do something by himself straight up that's going to help people. Like, AOC's win was huge, and it's important to have someone like that in federal government. But as a single U.S. House representative, she can't enact her agenda alone. So, you know, they can use these things to knock her. But Mamdani, there are things as mayor he can just outright do. And that's why they are so scared of this, because a democratic socialist has finally been given the office in which they can enact at least some of the things they outright plan to do on their own. And they are running scared because people will like it.
Can I just insert one other element to this? Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who is a sort of like right wing, she calls herself an ex-Muslim, and she's also somebody who was cited by Anders Breivik before he murdered 77 people in Norway, I think it was. And her response to that was, the people who failed to speak up against Muslims coming to Europe are the actual cause, and they left people like Breivik no choice. But anyway, Ayaan has a recommendation that I want to second, in fact. She responded to this novel that Bill Ackman wrote about being gravely concerned. She said, the answer is looking you in the face. You are the best candidate to run against Mamdani. The Michael Bloomberg of 2025, a dedicated New Yorker and the opposite of this guy in every respect. So I would just say, yes, please, Bill Ackman. Cuomo spent $100 per vote that he got. I want you to double that. I want you to spend $200 of your own dollars in order to lose in the general election as a running candidate against Zohra Mamdani. And please listen to these people like Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who are definitely not just trying to get you to open their checkbook and sponsor their next sort of venture in Islamophobia. They really mean what's best for you is to run against Zohran as a running candidate using your own money.
Right. These people have no idea about New York whatsoever. They don't know about the people who live here. They don't know about the politics of the people who live here. They know nothing about New York. I've seen people say, oh, we're going to let a election where only 9.1% of eligible voters voted. More people voted for Zohran Mamdani in the first round of this election than voted for Eric Adams last time around. And you don't see people denying that Eric Adams should have been mayor because less than 9% of people voted in the election in total. This is just how New York – this is really how it is in general. People most voters are sort of passive politically, and they just don't care enough about the primaries, and they let the more politically minded people hash that out, and then they come out in the general and just pick whoever their party chose. That's just how it is. I wish more people were active, but most people seemingly don't want to be.
You know who needs to be active? DSA, and that's who was, and that's why we won. Thank you to all the DSA folks who have been knocking so many doors, and that's not something that it's going to want to be emphasized by these people saying it's all about Zohran's Riz. I think it's about the people who were ready to go to battle for him, and they won.
Right. Right. So with that said, let's get to the interviews that Sam Cedar has awaiting us. Which one's up first, guys?
First, we got some ads, and then we're going to get to Alex Salmon.
Perfect. All right. Myself, Matt Leck, and the rest of the MR crew will see you shortly right after these Sam Cedar words from our sponsors.
Thanks, Matt. Today's episode sponsored by a company that I've been using for or service company, both for about 10 years, way before they decided to sponsor the program. It's Delete Me. And what Delete Me does is it makes it quick and easy and safe to remove your personal data online at a time when there's all sorts of things like surveillance or doxing or data breaches that help scammers and phishers and identity theft. Everyone is vulnerable to this now more than ever, particularly with a certain administration who is rolling back a lot of protections on like do not call lists, et cetera, et cetera. But what Delete Me does is they do all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information from data broker websites. You give them your email, you give them all the information you want not to be out there. And they keep scrubbing this stuff from data broker sites. In fact, sometimes you'll even get like an email from the data broker to like, if you didn't request, because what they're doing is they're requesting on your behalf to scrub all this stuff from all these sites. And then they give you updates in these email reports, essentially, what's been scrubbed, how many places they found your information, et cetera, et cetera. And they do it on a monthly basis because these data brokers, they repopulate. It is a constant struggle. But the beauty is Delete Me does all the work. It's not a one-time service. I want to thank Delete Me for sponsoring today's episode. I also appreciate them as a service. They have been scrubbing my info from the web for, like I say, years. With Delete Me, I protect both my personal privacy, the privacy of my business. And as you can imagine, with what I do, that's a good thing. Take control of your data. Keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me. Now at a special discount for you today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan by texting the word majority to 64,000. The only way to get 20% off is to text majority to 64,000. That's majority to the number 64,000. Message and data rates may apply. Also, this episode is brought to you by, in part, SockDoc. one of the problems that people have with seeing a doctor is how much of a pain in the butt it is. Because you don't know if the doctor will take your insurance. You don't know if you're able to set up an appointment. You don't even know which doctor to go to. We have all been there. Booking a doctor's appointment can feel daunting. So what do? You put it off, and then maybe you get sick. Thanks to ZocDoc, there is no reason to delay. They make it super easy to find a doctor and to book a doctor who's right for you. ZocDoc is a free app and website, for that matter, where you can search and compare high-quality in-network doctors and click to instantly book an appointment. Super easy. We're talking about booking in-network appointments with more than 100,000 doctors across every specialty, mental health to dental health, primary care to urgent care, and more and more. You can filter for doctors who take your insurance. You can filter for doctors who are located nearby. You can filter doctors for a good fit for any medical need you have. And you can filter for ones that are highly rated by verified patients. Once you find the right doctor, you can see their actual appointment openings. So there's no going back and forth. What about Thursday at 3? No, I can't do that. What about, can I do Thursday at noon? Well, no, the doctor's not there. You can see all the openings. You choose a time slot that works for you. You click, you're instantly booked a visit. Appointments made through ZocDoc happen so fast, typically within 24 to 72 hours of booking. So you can even score same day appointments. Both Matt and Emma have used ZocDoc for a whole host of doctor appointments. I was out of town once. I found my dentist that way. Not my dentist, but the dentist I needed at the time, because when you get old, sometimes you have dental emergencies. Well, I guess at any age. Anyways, I want to thank ZocDoc for sponsoring today's episode. Stop putting off those doctor's appointments. Go to ZocDoc.com/majority to find and instantly book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc, ZocDoc.com/majority. ZocDoc.com/majority. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Alex Salmon, feature writer at Slate.com. Alex, you wrote this amazing piece, disturbing in many respects, about Jenna, Louisiana, has a population of 4,000 people, has a crazy history of, I don't know that crazy, but a history of being closely associated with the carceral state for quite some time. Give us a little background about this before we get up to present day.
Yeah. So this is like central Louisiana. So it's, you know, a part of the state, part of the country. There's not a lot of economic activity. It's not a, you know, certainly not a metropolis. And so like a lot of these places, you know, it was an oil and timber town, basically, Gina. It's like you either work in the oil fields or the logging woods. And both those things went bust in the 80s. And so what happened there, as in many places in Louisiana, is they set out to diversify the economy and they built a prison, which was, you know, steady industry. It's like it's the way a lot of these towns bring federal money or state money to places that are pretty much, you know, blighted and forgotten about. So they built this prison in just outside of town. It was a juvenile detention center at first, and it's like 276 beds. Basically, from the moment it opened, it was like incredibly scandal plagued.
This a state juvenile facility? And so, okay.
Yeah, it was a state facility. And yeah, state facility, 267 basically teenagers. And it was like from the second it opened in 98. And I think with just over a year, it was so scandal plagued. Just the allegations of abuse are like stunning. That like the Clinton administration, which is obviously the tough on crime Clinton administration, which couldn't find a jail it didn't like the look of, they sued Both the state of Louisiana and Wackenhut, which was the private prison company that would eventually become GEO Group, basically alleging that there was like widespread mistreatment, borderline torturous conditions for these kids. And like the DOJ documentation from that period is like, it's pretty stunning. It's the catalog of abuse is like unbelievable. And they, at first they were like going to set up a deal to get it back on the straight and narrow. And then Wackenhut, the private prison company, was just like, never mind, we'll just shut it down. It's not worth the effort.
And this was an era when private prisons was really just starting to gear up, wasn't it?
Yeah. So it was like, really interesting, you know, the political economy of this stuff I think is fascinating, but right. It's sort of deeply neoliberal era where it's like, you want to build out state capacity to imprison people, but you don't really have the ability to do it on a public sector level, or you think it's cheaper to do it with the private sector. So Wackenhut is sort of the great exemplar of this as at that point, the largest private prison operator in the world, goes on to become GEO Group. Now we have GEO, which is the biggest in the country. And that's all before we get into immigrant detention, right? That's before this industry evolved. So that was, late 90s.
Right. And this is all sort of like a trajectory, I think, if I remember correctly, from the 80s, the early 80s, as you know, Reagan era. And it had really its biggest growth, I think, as far as I remember, I should say, until I think recently, in the wake of that client, that the crime bill under Bill Clinton, that sort of confluence of both the tough on crime era and the, like you say, neoliberal sort of more corporate policies of the Democratic Party. Okay, so what happens after it closes? Then what happens with this facility?
Yeah, so really short run, right? Not the most heartening ROI on that thing. They build it up. They get 16 months of basically child abuse. It gets shut down and emptied out. It sits empty for a handful of years until Katrina hits. And so this is, then becomes a classic Louisiana story where Katrina hits, and then there's another hurricane, the name of which now eludes me, but 3 weeks later there's another category 3 hurricane that hits. So like the lower latitudes of Louisiana are obviously flooded, and a lot of the prisons get flooded, so they need to relocate prisoners to different facilities, and they reopen this facility in Gina to house prisoners from other prisons that have been decommissioned by the storm. And so in 2005, it reopens, and they just relocate hundreds of prisoners up there and on an emergency basis. And they actually bring down, I mean, the staffing is not Wackenhut at this point. The staffing is actually, they bring down like CEOs from Rikers and other places in the state. And
so is this a state-run facility at that time, or is it Wackenhut just sort of like subcontracting back to they're just bringing people around for the rest of the country?
Yeah. I think they entered into an agreement with the state just to, on a temporary basis, emergency basis, to house people there, basically, quote unquote. So it's not even staffed up with private staff. It's staffed from other prisons, but of course, like, the behavioral pattern is exactly the same. It takes almost no time. I mean, the stories of even just relocating the prisoners to this place, like horrific, like the testimony about how they relocated the prisoners itself is stunning. And then you hear these reports come out later about how, I mean, unbelievable torrent of racial abuse for Black prisoners. And it too is so bad that they end up having to shut it down and empty it out again. It's
does Wackenhut, like, I don't understand. Like, it's one thing to say, like, we need to shut down this prison because there are abuses going on here, but how does the facilitator of these abuses, like, it's not the physicality of the prison that is problematic. It is obviously the company that's running it.
Right.
Like, how did they stay in business? And like, what kind of, when it gets shut down, are they just like, well, we tried, and they just walk away? Or like, how is there no recourse or accountability for the actual company?
It's pretty amazing. I mean, they rebranded, they became Geo Group. So, it's not that there was no movement in in their corporate behavior. I mean, I went through and I looked actually at earnings statements and shareholders reports and stuff from this period. And when the facility is empty, obviously, they're not happy about that. Right. On every balance sheet, there's a line for the Gina facility and it's empty and stuff. But at the end of the day, it's like, you know, it's bringing in, you get these federal contracts and you bring them down and there's a lot of, it's a lot of money. It's a big right. industry. And, you know, we've seen their political influence also grow and grow and grow. And Pam Bondi, of course, our esteemed attorney general, was a lobbyist for them up until the second that she took her current position. And, yeah, it's just, you know, it's just an incredibly remunerative industry finally. So,
And so, okay, it shuts down then, and then it gets a third life, I guess.
Yeah, third life. So it shuts down again after the post-Katrina debacle. And then, you know, they get the idea that they can expand it, actually. The incredible thing that happens is they're like, this is, you know, two tries, this have not worked. Let's make it way bigger. And so they build out a ton more bed space, out to 1,170 beds, which is obviously much larger than the 276 they started with. And they start marketing it to the federal government as a facility. And of course, at that point, ICE is a relatively new, department, right? ICE only is, you know, created in 2003. This is 2007 at this point that they're, shopping the facility around. And so they win a federal contract for ICE and, as it turns out, you know, ICE pays even better. Like it's a much better deal to get an ICE contract than it is to do state. So they're happy. And, 2008, it opens as an ICE detention center.
And I want to get to the part of the story about how the town reacts to this stuff, because, it really is fascinating and a little bit disturbing, but they start ramping up as an ICE facility through the Obama years, where there is a lot of, Obama was very aggressive in terms of deportations. So, you know, depending on who you talk to, but from their accounting, to build some credibility to develop comprehensive immigration reform, that was an abject failure, the entire project. By the end of the Obama administration, he puts a moratorium or ends private prisons for the federal government. Was this facility now considered a private prison, or because it had sort of changed its category to a detention center, was it not really subject to that? I mean, of course, Trump comes in and it reverses it immediately, so maybe there was no issue, but what happened in that instance?
Yeah, you know, I think that it would have been open just before Obama was elected. And I don't know how actionable that standard really was finally in terms of outstanding contracts. I don't want to speak too confidently on this because I don't really know the ins and outs of it, but I don't think that that affected this facility. And while it may have sort of slowed some of the ICE and private prison alliance, like ultimately ICE as a department is entirely reliant on private prison companies. It couldn't exist without them. And so like currently 90% of people in ICE detention are being held in private prison facilities. I don't think there was a big push during the Obama years to build public ICE facilities or ICE jails or whatever. So I don't know exactly the ins and outs of that thing, but it is interesting because during that you're very right to bring up that period, because it does slow down a little bit there. Like from 08 to 16, at least in Louisiana, you don't see growth in this industry. But then in 17, it goes crazy. And like that's, you know, sort of where it picks right back up is once Trump gets back in or I guess in the first time rather, like that, at least for Louisiana, is where, you know, the ICE detention industry takes off.
And we should say that, and Gina, it's extremely remote. 4,000 people. What percentage of the town works in the prison or is sort of like reliant on the prison? Because I imagine there may be some slight outside contracting that the prison does as well.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. So the 4,000 figure, and I went through census data on this. I think it also counts the people who are in the prison, which is, you know, common practice for prison towns. Like this is how they do this stuff. But, I went through that data. It said that Gino is 25% Hispanic. And there are 1,000 beds at the facility. And I went to, there's one Mexican restaurant in Gina, and I went there and I spoke with the wait staff and I said, you know, I was like, how many Latinos live here? It must be sort of an interesting dynamic. And the both people I spoke to were like, there are 15 Latinos here. So, the rest of the 1,000, I'm pretty sure are people that are in the facility. So it might really be even lower than that, you know, in terms of like functional population. Anyways, very small town. I think it's amazing about this is that the numbers are really like, they're very low, the numbers, right? Like I think that at most recent accounting that like the tax revenue to Gina specifically was like $30,000 a year. I think it's like 250 jobs. It's not like, you know, we're not talking about huge numbers. It's not like,
I mean, if you have 3,000 people in a town, you know, 250, it gets close to 10% from one employer.
Right.
And, you know, working age is probably, you know, maybe even a higher percentage.
Right. Totally. And you're right with subcontractors and everything else, right? Like, it's probably a little higher than that. And it does end up being a pretty substantial percentage in the final accounting.
And this is the facility that Mahmoud Khalil was held at.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So he was in there for, what was it? 104 days at final tally. It's an interesting place because it's the one place, right? He was the one who was stuck there the longest. Alirezi Darodi, who was the Iranian student from the University of Alabama, he was also held there for 40 days and then ended up giving up and just accepting deportation. So of the facilities in Louisiana, of which there are nine, and then there's a 10th just across the Mississippi border that's part of the New Orleans field office. This is the place I think is hard, you know, sort of like the hardest to get out of at a lot of levels. Like it's the oldest large one, and then of course the place where everyone else got out, and Khalil was held the longest of any of these students, and then. Of course, Tarudi got actually deported in the end. So
how long are, I mean, the detainees there are presumably in process of being deported, right? I mean, I don't know if the trend to Agua people came from Gina as well, but how long is the typical stay?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question because immigration court and the whole proceeding, it's very opaque and I think that not uncharitably is called kangaroo court by a lot of people who know it pretty intimately. Like the length of stay is basically like how badly do you want to be in this country, right? And it's like if you just give up and accept deportation, you might be gone in a matter of days. But if you feel like you have an asylum case that's legitimate or that you are in status, as often people are now, right, we're getting snatched by ICE agents, like, well, you probably don't want to just accept that and get deported.
Right.
What happens then once you're in the facility is that you can win your case and still not get out. So this is a very common story is that people will win their asylum case and then ICE has the ability to appeal those decisions and they can appeal again and again and again. So you can win
a
case.
You can appeal multiple times?
Yeah. You can appeal. They can appeal multiple times and they have time to decide if they want to appeal. So they don't even have to appeal immediately. You can sit there for 30 days while they're mulling over whether or not they will appeal. And so it's one of these things where like there was a man who died in detention in Gina who had already won his asylum case. Like he had been there for months after he'd already won his case. And it was just because ICE had decided that they wanted to appeal it. And so, you know, there he was. You know, by any estimation, you would say he was someone who had gone through all the, you know, all, it's so hard to win these cases. He had gone through all the hoops and won the case and was still there, and then ended up dying of a heart attack after, you know, he submitted multiple allegations of abuse by the staff there. And again and again and again, didn't matter. He was stuck, and then eventually he died of a heart attack. So those are not uncommon stories.
Talk a little bit about, before we go, the town. I mean, before we hopped on, it reminded me a little bit of Zone of Interest. Of course, you know, this is not a death camp, although for some it was, but it's not, its purpose is not, you know, to kill people. But you can see in your story how it feels like this detention center is a source of shame for the town, and that it sort of feels like it's slowly eating away at people.
Yeah, it was a really interesting environment to be in, because this is a town that does not love outsiders. I have like a pretty evident Southern California accent, and that was not doing me any favors talking to people around there. And there were some people who I think were very combative, right? Like most of the time I was in the town, or multiple times while I was there, I was getting trailed by the police. Like it was not like, there were two separate incidents where I was, you know, had the cops on my tail. And this is not a big town, and you know, it's not there's no secret what was going on. And when I tried to speak with the chief of police, it was very combative. When I tried to speak with the mayor, she, you know, one day escaped out of the back door. The next day didn't show up. The editor of the newspaper was extremely combative towards me. And the other people who I talked to were sort of between, you know, fearful and, you know, sort of cagey, and, no one wanted their name, on anything. And there was like, you know, there were some whispers, there were some things where like people would say, oh, you know, every once in a while someone shows up at the church and we don't ask them about their family. We don't ask what they're doing here. Like we just pray and we go about our business. And,
Church, presumably to visit the prison.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And it's like, given how, you know, how white the town is and stuff, and how insular it is, like everyone knows exactly what someone is doing. And if they have a family member in ICE detention, there's no surprise. But yeah, it was very much like, don't put anything on the record. Don't say anything. Like if, people would express stuff to me and then immediately take it back. I had a lot of interesting conversations like that where I would talk to someone and they would be like, please, please, please don't use my name. And it was a really interesting environment to be in and challenging on a reporting level. But I think, yeah, certainly had that sort of spirit of something like the Zone of Interest where, you know, everyone knows there's something going on up there, but it probably doesn't pay to make a lot of noise about it.
How many places like this are there around the country?
That is a great question. Central Louisiana is very unique because it's so remote and it has such a favorable court system for facilitating deportations. Like it's sort of a perfect storm of remoteness, lack of resources, willing political climate to facilitate both detention and deportation. There are places like this sort of all over the country, though. It's gotten, you know, Louisiana went from, you know, in 2017, I think there were two or three facilities. Now there are nine, you know.
Wow.
They opened five facilities in 2019 there. And they're all sort of peppered around these little towns in the middle of nowhere that are very hard to get to, purposefully so. And so there are mega, you know, there are giant facilities sort of scattered around the country. And Texas has got a few, and California's got some big ones. There's one in Washington. And Mississippi has a huge one. But yeah, they're you know, what's interesting right now is they're trying to expand this as well, right? There's a big push by the Trump administration to expand ICE detention. And so I think we're going to see more and more of these. What's interesting is that basically they identify prisons and jails that have been closed or not being used, oftentimes because of abuse allegations, and they dust them off and they turn them into ICE facilities. That's sort of the afterlife of pretty much any of these buildings.
Well, Alex Salmon, thanks so much for coming on and talking to us about your piece. We will link to it in Slate entitled Donald Trump is enacting his darkest agenda in the backyard of a small town. Absolutely no one wants to talk about it. I appreciate your coming on and telling us about it. Once again, thanks for coming.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for having me, Sam.
We're back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Claire Otterino. She is a barista and a member of the bargaining committee for the Blue Bottle Independent Union. She is on from Boston, and also joining us, BB Young from the Bay Area, a former barista at Blue Bottle. Welcome to you both.
Thank you for having us.
Hi, thank you.
So, Claire, let's start with you. Give us a little background on, for the folks who don't know, Blue Bottle and basically how this unionizing drive started.
So the unionizing drive started thanks to my comrades who came before me last May. So we recently celebrated our 1 year anniversary. Thanks to Alex Pine, who has appeared on More Perfect Union's bit about our union, such like that. They were very instrumental. They're our current president in helping us found the union. Did you want like a brand rundown on Blue Bottle itself?
Well, or? Yeah, I mean, just tell us, like, you know, it's give us a little sense of it, because I'm not sure that everybody's familiar with Blue Bottle. How many stores are there nationally? And where are they mostly located?
I should have the number. I'm not sure nationally. We have East Coast stores here in New York City where you're located. And then on the West Coast where it originated, then internationally, it's mainly East Asia. So like Korea, Japan.
Oh, so it's a pretty sizable, coffee outfit. And
yes.
And do you have a sense of how many, employees work at Blue Bottle?
I should also have that information. That's my bad. No, at our location, I would somewhere between like 10 and 20, at the moment.
And BB, tell me, your story. You're no longer working as a barista there?
No, unfortunately not.
Okay. Well, but tell me, what your involvement has been.
So I was a assistant manager, like cafe leader, alongside with my manager. And I was just help him with the day-to-day progress of just, you know, how to run the cafe and whatnot. And just because of that involvement, I wasn't too hands-on with the union, because I just plausible deniability, you know, and just not trying to cross too many wires. But I wanted to be more active and more a part of it. So I decided to read the letter with the rest of my cohorts, and then literally,
which yes. letter to back up and tell us, because we don't know this story.
So on June 17th, we made, you know, claimed that we wanted to have our union be public and be recognized by our company. And so we, on that Tuesday, we read a letter just of our demands of just livable wage, wanting to have, hours and having a certified and hours just being, sorry, I'm trying to see how to phrase the word. Just having,
more consistent hours or
consistent hours, and just hours that we were guaranteed when we first right. signed on and stuff, and such like that. And so I read the letter out loud to our guests and everyone who was in there. And then literally less than 24 hours, I was fired the next morning.
Wow. And so how many were you the only person fired? And
this I was the only one fired.
This was just last week.
Yes.
Oh, I see. Okay. And we should say this union drive has been going on since almost for a year and change, I guess, back in April of 2024. And Claire, where are we in terms of this is an independent union. Are you guys working with an affiliate with any other union to work through this, or
No, so we shopped around a little bit, but ultimately it was decided to remain independent. It gives us a little bit more freedom in terms of our collective action, and to be vocal on what we stand for. Like we're lucky enough to be able to release a statement on Palestine. We just sort of thought that everything worked better when the union was operated by the rank and file members who are like in the cafes.
And where is the union? Has it been certified? Is the union in every blue bottle around the country? Or was like BB's experience a function of a national thing? We can get to that, but give us a sense of the union from shop to shop. Like, how many shops are unionized? Are they recognized at this point?
Yeah, so in Massachusetts, the BVIU was initially founded for like Boston, Greater Boston. I guess that's technically the whole state, but obviously they're in the metropolitan areas. So right now we are in the talks of a contract. We won our union election. The Bay Area just announced their union campaign. So that's the letter that BB read and faced retaliation for immediately after.
So, if I understand correctly, all the shops in the Boston area are unionized. And are there any other, and the Bay Area is starting to, are there any other sort of, I guess, regional areas where the union has either operated or plans to operate? I guess maybe you can't tell me plans, but.
I can't tell any plans, but we were the first domino to fall, as it were.
And as it is now, the only domino that has fallen, and which takes us to Beebe's participation in this action. Were there any other people who were fired during that action?
No, I was the only one.
What is the justification that the company has given you to fire just you? Presumably, there were other people who read off this letter too, or no?
Well, they were trying to crack down on a lot of stuff, just within house, because I just feel like there was kind of a shakeup of just trying to get new staff and stuff like in. So there was a lot of us who were on like our final write-ups for like very small like stuff. Like me personally, I ended up getting my final write-up for being 4 minutes late to work. And so that was kind of the drive that pushed me was, I was like, if you're gonna fire me for being 4 minutes late to work, I personally didn't have anything else to lose, and I want better for my coworkers and my cohorts around me. So that, like I said, that's what pushed me to go, you know what? Yeah, I am going to read this letter, and I am going to let them know that I want this union to happen, and I want better for my staff. And so, then, like I said, the next morning they said, "Well, you were late for this amount of time, and we're letting you go."
How do you have a sense of how many folks in your particular shop and within the context of the Bay Area are interested in formalizing a union?
I think within at least my cafe, a good, like, I want to say like maybe 80, 90% are for it and are like ready for it. I know a lot of the other stores, also kind of have that same sentiment. Like I want to say 80, 90.
And so, how is it? I guess the and so are you guys planning a vote? Like, walk me through the process here. So, if we have a union that is representing folks who are working for this company, but it's only regional, like, why does each shop need to have a union vote? And will that, because the union is recognizing or is being recognized in the Boston area, in the event that each shop votes for it, will the company automatically recognize them as a union?
To my knowledge, as far as I know, I know when we first read off the letter, we asked them to try to recognize, not like try, but to recognize us on that following Friday. I'm not sure what date that was, but they no radio silence. Didn't say anything about it. Didn't recognize us. So I think if they are to recognize us, it would be as in the Boston area that they are going to cover the whole, at least East Bay part of the Blue Bottle chains.
And what are the next steps for in the event that they don't voluntarily recognize? Do you then have a vote? Like, where do we stand relative to A, the National Labor Relations Board? And I imagine you're also dealing with a regional national, I should say, a regional labor relations board as well.
Mm-hmm. Me personally, I'm unsure. I don't know if Claire can talk a little bit more about that than I could, because like I said, I'm still kind of new onto the hands of the whole shebang.
Claire, tell us, like, if you can, and tell us, like, what will happen. Like, how does a vote happen now in that one particular shop? And if that vote passes, who gets unionized, and has the company committed to recognizing the unionization of each shop or each region after having done so in Boston?
Right. So far the union, we brought this up in our last bargaining session, which was coincidentally the day, I think, after they read the letter off on the West Coast over there. The company's official response is that they declined to answer whether they will recognize us as a union, at least for now. It's sort of a strategic up in the air right now whether they'll be folded in to our bargaining unit. A lot of it depends on, from what I've been told about some of the people who are a little bit more senior to me and a little bit more involved in the organizing of it all, is it depends on where the company wants to draw the lines for the West Coast specifically, and then whether that should be a parallel contract or literally the same contract that we're still being stalled out for, because we don't even have our contract yet.
Interesting. And BB, tell me, like, what... when you decided to, what has been the reaction of your fellow workers after you were fired? And will, I don't know if this is a question for Claire, but, or for you, BB, but will there be some type of unfair labor practice filing take place in the wake of your firing?
Not to like put myself like on a pedestal or anything, but I felt like I helped harbor a lot of the community and closeness that I had with the customer base coworkers at my cafe. So it's like, for like a lack of a better word, it feels like I kind of died at the cafe. So the shakeup has been a little just unsettling with everyone, and especially with my other coworkers, because like I said, it's if they're going to retaliate and retaliate so soon off of something like that, you know, some of them are a little just worried of what else that they can see them under a microscope and what else that they can fire them and stuff off.
That's probably the purpose, yeah. I would imagine, is to scare other people.
Especially with me being an assistant manager. And it was like, if you can get rid of your assistant manager, you literally can get rid of any of us. And so a lot of the customer base were like, super unhappy and like not cool about it, because our cafe itself was is a neighborhood cafe, so we see all those like those people every day at least like once or twice, and so a lot of them has felt the shakeup itself, so it's just sad, it's unsettling.
I would imagine, and stressful, I would imagine, on you as well. And what about the filing of an unfair labor practice? I mean, it sounds like you were obviously targeted just for announcing. It seems like quite a coincidence. Let's put it that way.
Yes. I am talking to them. I haven't, I set up meetings, but nothing has been set in motion yet.
And so from your perspective, both BB and Claire, why don't you take this first? What can people do to help support you guys? I mean, I know that you're starting negotiations, and BB's shop is attempting to unionize in some fashion. And we also have a National Labor Relations Board that is largely dysfunctional at the moment. And we still have, particularly when you're talking about Boston and Los Angeles, or I should say California, still have labor relation, regional labor relations boards. What can people do to help in this environment?
So we do have a strike fund. We have striked multiple times this year so far. It's been one of the most effective forms of collective action that we've engaged in. The strike fund helps, replenish lost wages, obviously, for workers participating in the strikes. But also, as a plus of being an independent union, all of our bargaining notes are fully transparent and available on our website. So if any member of the public sort of wants to stay up to date on what's being passed back and forth over the table, recently we were able to get a tentative agreement that sort of secured some migrant rights in terms of protocols when dealing with ICE that were favorable. So that was a recent win that people can read all about and sort of like follow along to know in more real time what's going on with the union.
We'll put a link to that. And from your perspective, BB, I mean, it sounds like these shops are hubs for the community. And I would imagine the customer base can influence what these shops end up doing with their employees. How else can folks help out in your situation?
For me personally, I have a GoFundMe if you would like to support to me directly at tinyurl.com/defund sorry, defendbb, defendbb. And then I know just I this has ignited a little bit of a fire within myself. And I hope that with the other cafes, not only just like us California-based cafes, but also like the New York ones and stuff like that. I know that they can go to the Blue Bottle Union dot org website, and they can also get in touch with everyone there if they want to even try to unionize and try to get their stores, recognized and get their rights and stuff taken care of.
Bluebottleunion.org. We'll put that link in the podcast and YouTube description. Claire, BB, thanks so much for coming on and talking to us about it. Good luck with your respective fights that you have with
Thank you,
Blue Bottle.
Sam.
I hope this company does the right thing by you guys.
We'll see.
Thank you so much, Sam.
Everyone, and welcome back to the show. I hope you enjoyed those Sam Cedar interviews after myself and Matt Leck had some fun at Bill Ackman's expense. And now joining us on the show, as we're about to head into the fun half of the program, is Brandon Sutton. Brandon, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, Matt?
I'm doing good, as we were talking before. A little bit better than usual. A little bit of a skip in my step since Tuesday night's election results.
Yeah, I try not to embrace like the politics of pettiness. I think that's become such a core premise on what drives so many people in our political system. So I try not to I'm not trying to indulge in that too much, but watching the right-wing commentators, watching the turbo libs have their varying degrees of meltdown has been something to behold. And I should say meltdowns about right. Zoran, obviously, or as I've been calling it on my stream, Zoran derangement syndrome. And I think it's spreading. It's spreading like wildfire.
Right. Right. What is it? That would be ZDS, right? Yes.
ZDS.
Yeah. Mm. It's funny because it's across the board. You got the libs having varying reactions from like the abundance guys all of a sudden crediting abundance.
Oh, yeah.
It's so funny. Yeah. Binder, just to jump in on that, you have people like Matt Iglesias who are like, oh, well, this is just a fluke. You shouldn't have ran a pervert like Cuomo at the top of the ticket.
literally like hours before the election results came in. Iglesias was literally saying, like, you know, Zoran ran a pretty good campaign. It's too bad he ran on socialism. That's going to hurt him a lot.
Oh. Mm.
Mm. Yeah. That's what he's paid to say. He can. Yeah. Matt Iglesias, at this point in his life, cannot reach an alternative conclusion.
Was he an Adams guy? Was that like Matty Iglesias' horse?
I don't know if
race?
He was, but Nate Silver certainly was. I'll never forget the Nate Silver tweet shortly after Eric Adams won the election in 2021, where he said something like, you know, I shouldn't really be looking too much into a New York City mayoral election this way. But Eric Adams got to be one of the top five picks now for the future of the Democratic Party and their next one of their next presidential contenders. And it's like, wow, could anyone have been more wrong?
I don't know. Who's wrong more often now, Nate Silver or Jim Cramer? Like if they had like a wrong off, who do you think would have like the worst run of right. predictions?
I don't know. I mean, for this one, Nate Silver did it again, where just like Iglesias, a few hours before, maybe it was the night before the election, Silver posts a screenshot of the what's the gambling website that pays him and he doesn't disclose it?
Polymarket.
Polymarket, yes. He posted a screenshot of the Polymarket like a graph showing where people's money is going. And he's using that as if it was an actual poll. And he posts one that shows it was one that came shortly after Mamdani had a bump that came close to Cuomo. And then as that second poll that ended up being super wrong came out, it went back down from Mamdani and Cuomo took the lead again. He posted it right after that, a screenshot of the Polymarket graph right after that. And he was like, you know, maybe if this was 2 weeks ago, Mamdani could pull it off, but it's not looking very good.
I mean, a lot. So much of that is wish casting. So much of what counts as like deep, serious punditry in liberal and conservative spaces is just like you know, vocalizing your own biases without attributing them to that.
Right. I mean, it couldn't have gone worse for these the pollsters. I believe the only one who had any polling showing Mamdani in the lead, well, there was the Emerson one that came out the day before.
Yeah.
But then public policy polling had one like weeks before. And like he outdid it all. He outdid all the pundits. There was the best case scenario for Mamdani was at the end of the final round of ranked choice voting, he would finally come ahead of Cuomo after all the other votes were redistributed, after he got all of the Lander voters who put Zoran second. And not only did he not need any of that, he was by and far away the first place choice for so many people that Cuomo isn't even a sure thing for an independent run anymore.
Cuomo was an incredibly weak candidate. I think, you know, Matty Iglesias is right in that analysis. Like Cuomo might have been the perfect storm for badness that guaranteed this kind of result, or at least facilitated this kind of result. Cause I don't want to minimize like Zoran's ground game, Zoran's like compelling vision for New York City. But like Andrew Cuomo ticked all the wrong boxes for what they would be trying to sell in a Democratic Party primary. In many ways, like trying to get him over the line was just their micro version of the 2020, you know, Democratic primary for president in Joe Biden v. Bernie Sanders. They were trying to get another, you know, another alleged sex criminal over the line in, you know, the form of Andrew Cuomo to dispel the illusions of the left that they might have a chance at power. But in this case, they weren't able to do it. You know, I think it has to do with the unique makeup of New York City in many ways. And then also like the unique nature of like what Andrew Cuomo resigned as a result of.
Right.
You know, there's one final thing before we do plugs and get to the fun half, but this quote here, is this New York Times or Washington Post? I can't tell. This is, Puck News, I guess, maybe. Or no, alum. So maybe this is MSNBC. I'm not sure where exactly he's reporting this, but he says, as donors try to assess their next moves in the mayoral race, one of the biggest donors to Andrew Cuomo's super PAC, the investor Mark Gorton, who I looked this up, he's the creator of LimeWire. shout out to the Limp Bizkit Urban Assault vehicle MP3 that I got 25 years ago. Mark Gorton said he is likely to back Mamdani. That is because of the support that Mamdani has gotten from Brad Lander, who Gorton said he ranked first. Quote, I feel like people misunderstood my 25... let me just say this. People like,
250?
Like, yes, exactly. 50,000, I feel like people misunstood my $250,000 for Cuomo for real enthusiasm, Gorton said in an interview. It was basically, oh, looks like Cuomo is coming back. We don't want to be shut out. Let's try to get on his good side. That's kind of how things work with Cuomo. It's sad political pragmatism. Right. I wish we lived in a world where these sort of things were not useful things to do.
Right. And that's definitely something to be said about Cuomo and his brand of like mafioso politics. That's how he ran Albany when he was governor. But also, like, it says a lot about how the rich people donate. I mean, when I sent Bernie Sanders $27 back in 2016, that was the absolute most enthusiastic I've ever been.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I can't imagine how enthusiastic I'd have to be to part with $250,000.
It's just a business expenditure. It's like, for some people, once you're giving that much money into the political machine, it's a business expenditure. I think, you know, we like to pretend, and by we, I mean the people who are taking that money like to pretend that it has no impact on them. So that's not the way it should be viewed. But yeah, it's not the same as the donations that Bernie get. It's a much more quid pro quo situation.
Right. All right, so let's go to the fun half. There's a lot of stuff to get to, a lot of great clips. I will be live tonight with Leftist Mafia at youtube.com/Matt Binder. I believe we have a special guest joining us tonight, Ole, who is Eric Adams' number one arch nemesis. So it'll be interesting to hear what she's got to say about the upcoming general election now that Zohran is the Democratic pick. And Brandon, while I hand my daughter off to someone else, can you say what's going on with your show this week?
Yes, absolutely. So I actually just finished streaming right before coming on to the Majority Report, and you can find that past stream in my next stream, which probably won't be tomorrow, but sometime this weekend on my YouTube channel, The Discourse with Brandon Sutton, which is also a Twitch channel that you can watch the exact same stream on at the exact same time, The Discourse on Twitch. So
very nice.
Be there.
Matt Leck, what do you got going on this week?
Left Reckoning, we did a Tuesday, we did a big public show on Iran, two guests, Derek Davis and Eskander Sadeghi. Also talked about the fight between Abbott and Patrick in Texas over THC and the, really an insane political system they have in that state. Sunday show, patreon.com/Left Reckoning. David and I will be back Sunday for patrons.
All right, perfect. And we will, Sam will be back live tomorrow on the show if this is where you say goodbye to us. But otherwise, we'll see everybody else in the fun half.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now. And I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now. But I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who?
Fun.
What is up, everyone?
Fun.
Nomi Key.
You did it.
Fun.
Let's go, Brandon.
Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this 7A?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is it safe?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
Oh, I'm going to go start off.
You libertarians.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say.
857-210-3501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this. Poop.
You can call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we've seen you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick, so screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.
You're back.
All right, we are back, everyone. Welcome back to the fun half on the Majority Report. Matt Binder, Brandon Sutton, Matt Leck. No Emma. Emma's still away on her honeymoon. I heard she called into the show yesterday, and that was quite a fun time. I missed it, though. I guess I got to go back and watch. What should we start with? We want to start with, so Matt Leck is logging us into the phone system right now.
Yeah, so
in the studio.
While we do that, I got this video that just crossed the timeline from Kenzo Fukuda, who's a Clutch Points. Looks like he's a Golden State Valkyries and Warriors beat writer. He's in New York and talking to New York Liberty player Natasha Cloud. And I thought what Natasha had to say here was very cool to see from our professional athletes.
To ask also about Zoran Mamdani.
Mamdani, my boy!
Big win, right?
It's a big win for the people. It's a huge win for the city of New York. And for me, as an athlete, no matter what market that I go into or what organization I play for, it's really important to care about the community that I play for as well. And so understanding what a pivotal moment this was for the city, what a pivotal moment it is for the working class people, and just overall, I think a lot of things can be said about Mamdani. He gets the worst PR because he's a Muslim, he's a socialist, and he's a Democrat. But he believes that it is the government's right to take care and make sure that all of its constituents live a dignified life, regardless of who you are, what your religious affiliation or background is. And I think that's beautiful. The ability to freeze 2 million tenants' rent in a time that we're headed for a recession within the next quarter, I think it's really important for the people of New York with a tax that was raised for rent by Cuomo a few years ago, That's just all around. He wants better buses so you can get to and from work quicker. He wants to fund more into our public schooling, making sure kids eat lunch for free as they should. That's a necessity of families that I think it is a government's responsibility to carry, while also allowing police to do their jobs, which is focus on actual crimes and homicides and things that are happening in the city, but also delegating and opening jobs to mental health professionals and social workers to handle anything that isn't deemed within a homicide or a violent act. And I think that just creates peace, that creates love, it creates understanding. It separates that friction between community and police too by allowing them to just do their normal jobs. So I think overall it's just like, it's the right choice, but why it's so powering for me is it restored my hope in humanity a little bit. That, yeah. You know, even with the confines of what's happening right now in our government and in our country, that the people will speak, the people will show up, and there's a lot of humanity left in this world for us to care about one another.
Definitely. I was going to ask a follow-up about hope, but I think you...
We don't get the wow. Answer there, but yeah, amazing. And she is a 2019 WNBA champion, WNBA peak performer in assists in 2022, and three-time all-defensive selection.
Yeah, it's great to hear that from a professional athlete. I'm sure she'll get a lot of shit for it. I'm sure she'll get shit that has absolutely nothing to do with her support from Amdani, just right-wingers attacking her for all the usual things they attack, accomplished women, especially women of color, for. So kudos to her for speaking out on it, period, because she's going to get a lot of crap, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. I mean, but, you know, she's not as articulate on the issue of politics as some of the right-wing celebrities you hear, like Bryce I Love Hitler Mitchell from the UFC,
or, right.
You know, Eric Adams' best friend and streaming partner, like Sneeko, right? So, like,
right.
What can you expect?
Well, right. She's be more educated on the issues like they are, right?
Yeah, yeah. She's not sophisticated in her analysis.
Didn't she listen to Riley Gaines about how much the right wing cares about women's sports? Like, how come that isn't making any kind of impression on her, I wonder?
Right, yeah. I'm sure those same Riley Gaines fans are going to come at her and do some sort of transvestigation or something, I'm sure. That's all they do. Anyone speaks out against them, you could be the most stereotypically feminine woman on the planet. They'll automatically clock you as trans because they don't like you.
Riley Gaines, a 25-year-old from where? I like her. Thanks for Nashville. Oh, yeah. Please give me your opinions about New York City and when New York City is over. A 25-year-old from Nashville whose only like claim to fame is finishing tied for fifth in a swimming competition.
All of the people who live in suburbs that like pepper our Midwest, that like feed into places like Chicago and Indianapolis and, you know, et cetera, who have been afraid of going to New York City because of the crime epidemic for the past 30, 40, maybe even 50 years, are telling us that now New York City is over because we have a mayor who wants to freeze the rent and, you know, maybe do something about crime that's just not give cops tanks, right? So like, but like those people are the, you know, the people who are like, they have the fingers on the pulse of what's going on in New York City because they live their life in fear of it.
Right. We're going to hear from Riley Gaines and she's going to tell us all about how Scott Stringer actually won the mayoral race. I just looked. He's the current fifth place. Stringer.
That's a good point, though. I mean, ultimately, like, right wingers have such a fantastical image of New York City in their head anyway. Why don't they just like imagine it has a different mayor? Like, when, you know, like when they're imagining that every, you know, every street corner is littered with syringes and hypodermic needles and crack pipes and you can't take two steps without being accosted by some sort of violent migrant criminal. Like, just imagine that someone else is mayor. Just like, imagine some other part of that fantasy. Like, who cares? It's not reality anyway. So.
All right. All right. It is amazing how they even like knock Cuomo for being like, not a good candidate. Don't wonder Mamdani beat him. Like Cuomo, I believe, I'm pretty sure this is the first time Andrew Cuomo ever lost an election. I mean, even with all his baggage, this was a formidable opponent that had the entire Democratic establishment behind him. Like, and Mamdani beat him and beat him handily.
Yeah, I know. I think a lot of people, not just Democrat establishment figures, but also like more Republican establishment figures are mad at Cuomo for dropping the ball. There is like an unspoken covert contract that exists that it's supposed to be people like Andrew Cuomo's job to prevent people from like Zohran from getting into positions of power. And by nature of how Andrew Cuomo comported himself in office, he made himself invalid in that role. I mean, obviously Eric Adams did as well, but Eric Adams at this point is like a Batman villain roaming around the city. So what are you going to do about that? But Andrew Cuomo is getting like the brunt of this pushback because, like, you know, people like him exist to prevent people like Zohran from coming into positions like he's able to now.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's clear why Cuomo ran here. Like it was basically like, you do this for us and you're back. You're back. You're looking for you resigned in disgrace. Your career, your political career and aspirations were over. You come, you do this for us. You be the candidate that's going to win and beat all these other guys. And you're back in the fold. Your presidential aspirations down the line are back on. And he clearly was fine with just doing that for those reasons, because his heart was never in New York City and being the mayor of the people of New York.
Oh, yeah. And I think it read the entire time. There was a lack of authenticity. And, you know, I think a lot of people are mad for a lot of different reasons. And the two main ones is that this election, this victory for Zohran and for the working class people of New York City, is a referendum on establishment politics as usual, not just Democratic Party establishment, but Republican Party establishment politics as usual. And it's an opportunity for leftists to have a case study, a very visible case study for, you know, to provide proof that the policies that we've been advocating for decades in some people's cases actually are effective at driving the kinds of changes that oftentimes are presented as impossible to generate by, you know, neoliberals and neoconservatives in our government.
All right. Yeah. It'll be fun to watch what they do. But before you joined us earlier at the start of the show, Brandon, we were talking about Bill Ackman and his ingenious plan to field a write-in candidate instead of getting behind one of the other four non-Mamdani candidates and coalescing around one of them to stop the evil socialist scourge. He's fielding a write-in candidate, and his selling point, his sales pitch to that potential candidate is, you don't have to do anything. The election is only 100 some odd days away, and I got tons of money at my disposal, so just help us out.
Bill Ackman really has become like a recurring villain online now. I kind of thought that he would blow over after the whole, like, you know, getting rid of the president of Harvard, super wife guy, my wife is also a plagiarist, allegedly kind of thing. But every week he has something else going on. And he's really just like, I would be exhausted if I was Bill Ackman. I'm just going to put that out there.
Look, he's a perfect sort of example of how money lets bullshit defy gravity, because he's permanently, and can anybody name the main contribution he's made to the world? In terms of, like, what, did he make any good business deals? Any trades? No. Off the top of your head, you can't. Nobody listening to me can. And even if, and I've done this exercise before, I've like looked to see what I would even cite. And it's just, he's a guy who traded. He buys and sells at the right time. Like, you know, like these are not actually producers. These are not people that add anything to society. The most famous thing he's ever done is lose a bet to a pyramid scheme or multi-level marketing scheme, Herbalife. He, like, 12 years ago, he took out a short bet against Herbalife because, as we all know, it's a multi-level marketing scheme. And then a different billionaire decided, I want him, I don't like him, and I think we can kind of see why, because he's not a likable guy. So I'm going to float Herbalife. I think it was Carl Icahn. Just give them a whole bunch of money so Bill Ackman eats crap. And he ate crap. And that's his most famous contribution to the world, is basically saying a multi-level marketing scheme was going to fail. Because actually, he knows less about capitalism than we do. Because multi-level marketing schemes are perfectly at home in capitalism. They can last a long time. Amway, for instance. Look at, I've talked to the boys in the Brigham Young Money podcast about how much of Utah is just multi-level marketing schemes. But he's got a lot of money, so it doesn't matter how stupid he is.
Well, I mean, I think this election, you know, one other thing that it was a referendum on was this reality that, you know, money is not everything in every election. There's been so much work done to justify the unfettered access that special interest money has to Democratic Party politicians' pockets and coffers, that it's just become a truism that people believe that like having more money just means that you win, despite multiple times that not being the case. You know, Hillary Clinton outspent Donald Trump in the 2016 election, most famously. But in this case, I think Andrew Cuomo had almost like five times more money. You know, a lot of that coming from Super PAC at some point than Zohran, or some, you know, multiple of what Zohran had. But that money had a cost. It was coming from sources that were quite transparently looking to shape the, you know, landscape of New York City, its policy landscape, in a way that didn't benefit the working class people who ultimately were the ones who were going to be casting their vote. And so I look forward to Bill Ackman pumping and losing millions of his own dollars into this election, because it will continue to prove the point that, like, you know, some money is bad money. And the more we can prove that point, the more we can get people away from just accepting that, you know, politicians, Democrat politicians, have to take money from billionaires, because otherwise, how will they win? How will they be competitive?
Yeah, and I would encourage him to, if he does run, continue making it all about Israel, to the exclusion of any other type of attacks on Mamdani, because to not only win the mayoralty with the Democratic Socialist, but also put to bed this heinous smear, which is that anybody that has a problem with how Israel conducts itself and how America supports it in that conduct is an anti-Semite. It's the biggest fucking joke of this century so far, that we can't have an honest discussion about this stuff. And I hope that what this campaign does is turn the page on that once and for all.
All right. I'm dying to see who I don't think he's going to run, but I am dying to see who he's going to get. I think the most realistic scenario is no one comes forward because they see what ridiculousness it is, just for their own career. And he just ends up putting a ton of money into Eric Adams. I mean, that seems to be what the outcome is, the most logical outcome.
Yeah. And I mean, this type of victory really salts the earth for that, because if it was one thing, if he would have sneaked across in the eighth round, he blew him out in the first round. Like, people showed up for him. Like, that is, like, when you see that guy, that LimeWire guy that I mentioned earlier, he's not a good guy. He gives money to RFK, and for, like, anti-vax stuff. Like, he's a psycho. He's another one of these Silicon Valley psychos that have all the money that should have gone to keep people in their houses after the financial crisis, but instead we gave it to banks to give it to freaks like that to make surveillance applications for commerce and, you know, the NSA. But what Mamdani did was bring them all to heel and make them bend the knee, which is, as Will Miniker was saying, is what ultimately needed to happen for the left in this country to ever have any sort of coherent ideology that people understand as something that will translate to power.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. It's something that's incredibly necessary at a time where people across the political spectrum are becoming disillusioned with the powers that be, with the establishment. It's going to be so important to have a case like New York City, a mayor like Zohran to point to show an alternative to what will be like the common sense narratives that start to trickle into our, more legacy media space surrounding like, well, you know, maybe Trump wasn't hard enough on immigrants. In fact, he wasn't so hard on immigrants. Maybe all of this continued material deprivation that you're seeing around you after Trump, after Gavin Newsom, maybe like just means that we have to be more explicitly fascist. Having a situation like, you know, a socialist or Democratic socialist mayor in New York City enacting like wide sweeping structural changes is going to make it easier to prevent people from being, well, as many people, I should say, from being like suckered into this idea that like what's wrong with society can be fixed with the same old neoconservative, neoliberal talking points, but maybe ramped up far enough to just be explicitly fascist now.
Right. Yeah, they don't want him there because he's going to be able to carry out his agenda in a way that I said this earlier too. Like, as big as having some Congress people in federal government on the left, they can't just outright go there and enact parts of their agenda. This is not how that position works. As mayor, he'll be able to just outright do some of the things that he said he wanted to do. There's not going to be a whole litany of people he needs to get behind a bill and vote on it. And then that goes to the Senate. And then, no, this is, he's going to be able to just do things.
Which will also set a bad precedent because it'll make, you know, people wonder why Democrats and other executive branch positions in government, governors, president, et cetera, don't wield power the same way, especially when they see the actual impact that the policies that he's proposing will have on people's lives. They'll want them for themselves. And, you know, they won't care if you call it socialism. They won't care if you call it communism. Maybe there will be some dead enders and, you know, the number of those people will dwindle over time. But I'm sure there will be some dead enders who like just like inevitably will not be won over by the material impact that the policies have. But I think more and more people, especially at a time where cost of living is out of control, where people can't afford transportation, people can't afford food, people can't afford like education for their children, they're going to see what he's offering and just and want those things because they'll want to better their own lives. Like the promise of bettering your own life or bettering your children's life is a very, very, very attractive promise. And it's ultimately what every politician is selling. Unfortunately, the politicians in both Republican and Democratic Party are selling, you know, a false promise there.
Right.
Just be moderate.
I mean, they'll be. What were you saying?
I was saying just be moderate, and that's the way to win elections.
Right. Yeah, just suck more.
There'll be some things that he won't be able to do without, you know, Kathy Hochul, for example. And I hope he uses the bully pulpit at his fullest to let everyone know because, you know, Cuomo was infamous for hurting New York City because of his feuding with Bill de Blasio. And so, you know, if Kathy Hochul doesn't want to get on board and she wants to play those same Cuomo-like corruption games, then we're coming after her too.
Well, you know, I think honestly what you're saying, what you said about Cuomo reminded me of another strategic error he made when running for mayor of New York City. Like I personally, if I were like a, you know, legacy dynasty Democratic establishment candidate running for mayor in New York City, I would not have by nature of my policy agenda during a, you know, incredibly deadly pandemic lead to an outsized amount of death in the elderly population, because those are probably going to be a lot of your voters. And so like, you know, in some ways you're suppressing your own voting base, which I think the Democratic Party establishment has that problem generally. And this is just one manifestation of that. But like, yeah, I think he really shot himself in the foot 3-4 years before this election even.
Right. Yeah, it is. It would be interesting to know exactly where
he lost like, by exactly was, the amount of people.
I would love to see like, if there was like an electoral map, you know, how there's one that shows like the demographics, like breakdown based on like race. It'd be interesting to see a breakdown of where the people he sent to those nursing homes resided. And then overlay that map over the electoral results of 2025.
No, I joke. I think it's both and, right? I think a lot of people are dissatisfied with the politics that are the Democratic Party establishment's politics. And then, you know, Andrew Cuomo resigned in disgrace as a alleged sexual criminal. There were people who were supporting him this time who called for criminal investigations into Andrew Cuomo. And once he resigned as a result of that, he basically admitted that he, you know, he was taking responsibility for it, did it. It's not a situation where he just denied forever. Probably if he had done that, they would have maybe opened a criminal investigation. So it made sense to resign. But that's just one thing that is always going to paint you in a negative light within, I think, the Democratic Party in a way that maybe it doesn't have such a big outsized impact in the Republican Party's electoral choices. Because like Democrats, you know, they sell themselves as the party of, you know, women's rights. They sell themselves as the party of like feminism in opposition to the Republican Party's, you know, aggressive, toxic masculinity, aggressive misogyny and sexism. And so when they put forth candidates that have histories of alleged sexual misconduct, it just puts a bad taste in people's mouth. It makes them seem like hypocrites. And in some ways it energizes the opposition.
Right. And you're going to see a ton of people who told him, called on him to step down and then endorsed him, try to sweep that under the rug in the future so they can continue to like,
it's so disgusting.
You cannot let them. This needs to be held against them forever. In fact, if you stayed out of this race even, and after Andrew Cuomo threw his hat in the ring and you had called for him to resign previously and then you just kept your mouth shut, it is the equivalent of endorsing him, in my opinion.
You know what makes it especially disgusting is that like there's been seemingly no work done on Andrew Cuomo's part to like rehabilitate himself as a result of, or you know as it pertains to like his, you know, again, alleged sexual misconduct. Obviously, there was not a criminal investigation. There was an investigation that seemed to indicate that he was guilty of what they were alleging, and he resigned, right, which also gives the impression that that is the case. But there wasn't a criminal investigation, so I guess we just have to say alleged in this case. So there were instances, many instances of alleged sexual misconduct that targeted employees under him. And so, you know, if you endorse him to get back into a position of power after he has shown absolutely no remorse for what he's done to women under his control, under his power and his employ, like, you're basically just like, you're ensuring that there are going to be more victims, essentially. That was what was happening there. Like, there were people who were like looking at their political, doing the political calculus for what was best for their career and going like, well, if he happens to sexually harass a few more interns, if he happens to, you know, engage in a little bit of sexual misconduct with a few more women against their will, well, that's just that sometimes you got to break a few eggs to make an omelet.
Right. Yeah.
It was just, yes.
But it seems like the days of like Brad Lander said yesterday or the day before, the days of Cuomo are gone. He is no longer the present or future. Good fucking riddance. And I hope that's the case. I hope that's the case.
I think he's done. And I mean, what's fascinating to me about this moment, though, is the power vacuum that Mamdani is able to rise up in. Everyone's talking about how bad of a candidate Cuomo is. That is a structural problem. That is not an accident of history. The Democrats don't have people that... Obama was a once-in-a-lifetime thing. And frankly, if he didn't come, they wouldn't probably even know that they could do that because it is hard.
Right.
They've been trying to replicate the Obama seller of the status quo for like since before he came around and since. But there's no one. Who is that? Who plot Elisa Slotkin? So now when MSNBC talks about opposing the current regime in power, they bring in Zohra Mamdani. And this, he had a good talk here with, what's her name? Who is this? Jen Psaki.
Is it Jen Psaki? Oh, right.
Yeah. The former Biden spokesperson who got out of there before she had to sell a genocide, which is smart on her
also
part.
Also, oddly enough, she didn't end up being the worst Biden spokesperson. She did get out at the right time, right?
Exactly. She got out there just the right time. I'll let Karine Jean-Pierre do the Gaza stuff. But here she is talking to Zohra. And this whole interview, I just think like we are very lucky to have Zohra. And I also think DSA can produce these people. The point is, are they going to be suppressed by our political establishment? And hopefully this we've seen the limits of their ability to do that. But here's Zohra with Jen Psaki.
As I'm sure you know, you probably haven't consumed all of it, I suppose, but there's been a lot of analysis, a ton, on what your success last night and in the last couple of weeks means nationally for the Democratic Party. Unquestionably, it means something about how people campaign. But what do you think it means?
I think it is part of a larger referendum on where our party goes. And I think one of the hopes that we had from the very beginning of this campaign was to move our political instinct from lecturing to listening. You know, at the national level, after the presidential election, we saw that New York was actually the state with the largest swing in the country towards Donald Trump, 11.5 points, and that swing took place far from the caricature of Trump voters, instead taking place in the hearts of immigrant New York City. And I went to those neighborhoods. I went to Fordham Road in the Bronx and Hillside Avenue in Queens, and I asked those New Yorkers, the vast majority of whom were Democrats, why they voted for Trump and what it would take to bring them back to the Democratic Party. And again, what I heard from them was cost of living, was an inability to afford the very things they recalled being able to purchase 4 years ago. And when they told me what it would take, they said again and again, a relentless focus on an economic agenda. And ultimately, in listening to them, we built a campaign that was explicitly about making this city affordable. And I think too often in politics, there's a desire to impose what you think the debate is upon the people that you're seeking to represent, as opposed to listening to the very issues that are making it difficult for them to keep calling the city that they love the city that they live in.
I just want to pause it there. It is so dangerous that it took this sort of action to interpret the shift. And instead, the interpretation that the media wanted to go with was, oh, even the immigrants like Trump's border crackdown. No, it was because people can't afford their fucking rent. And it should have been so obvious, but we have a media that is sort of basically constituted to ignore those sorts of realities.
Right.
I mean, you are running on issues that are very relevant to people in New York City, the cost of housing, free busing. Some have projected, that this is the type of platform that would work in other parts of the country. I mean, you're a proud democratic socialist. Do you think that is a platform that would work for other candidates running in other parts of the country?
Absolutely. I think ultimately this is a campaign about inequality. And you don't have to live in the most expensive city in the country to have experienced that inequality because it's a national issue. And what Americans coast to coast are looking for are people who will fight for them, not just believe in the things that resonate with their lives, but actually fight and deliver on those very things. And part of how we got to this point was through the endorsements of Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Bernie Sanders, who've been leading this fight against oligarchy across the country. And I think that in focusing on working people and their struggles, we also return back to what makes so many of us proud to be Democrats in the first place.
Let's talk a little bit about the path forward here, because you still have to win a general election, and that is going to be hard fought, which I know you know. You're on track to defeat Andrew Cuomo. He called you to concede. Afterwards, a couple of times, he seems to have floated this potential plan or consideration of running as an independent. Are you preparing for him to run as an independent in the general election, or do you think it's possible he could drop out entirely before next Tuesday?
I think that everything is possible in this race, as we've seen over many, many months. And ultimately, we are prepared for taking on whomever our opponents may be in November. Because when I started this race, I started it running against Eric Adams' second term, running to finally have a city government that sought to resolve the affordability crisis, not exacerbate it. And when Eric Adams dropped out of the Democratic primary, it was Andrew Cuomo that picked up the mantle of that second term. The same donors, the same corruption, the same small vision funded by big money. And we have now defeated that vision in this primary, and I'm prepared to defeat that vision in the general, no matter who it is that's carrying it.
Mm. He's good. He's good.
Such a great answer. I'm always impressed by the way he's able to answer these kinds of questions in ways that don't, you know, just reframe them. Things that we're always asking Democrats to do, like just don't concede the narrative. Don't concede the framing. Don't concede every, you know, underlying point Republicans have set out for you that ultimately just end up like illegitimizing whatever point you're going to make in the future.
Right. It's also very smart tying Eric Adams and Cuomo together over and over again that way to people who might not look at it that way, even though it's true, obviously, because look at how people came out to stop Andrew Cuomo in the primary. Let's repeat that again in the fall and stop the Andrew Cuomo of the general election, Eric Adams.
Yeah, and also like tying him to Donald Trump, because I got some of those like anti-Andrew Cuomo ads and saw how willing he was to like, you know, say Cuomo is another Trump, like use Trump's image in contrast to a Democratic candidate as a negative. And, you know, I think that's going to be incredibly important going forward, especially as, you know, Democrats might, you know, find themselves like John Fetterman, you know, allied with Trump a lot more and being needing to be primaried.
Right. Let's go to the phones. Let's take a call. 308. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Hey, it is Kowalski from Nebraska.
Kowalski, how are you doing? What would you have to talk about?
I just wanted to call before the before I guess they start setting up the camps in Central Park and New York, you know, falls to whatever it is that I keep seeing on the news at the gym. It looks pretty bad. Sharia law 24/7. Children.
Well, you're talking to people who will be at the command posts, though. We'll be fine.
I mean, speak for yourself. I'm actually applying for lead executioner at the Central Park execution platform. You know, I have a strong back, a good swing, and I'm looking to be put to work.
I guess, what do they do in the Big Apple? Are you guys like guillotine people.
Well, Dave Rubin, Dave Rubin told us it's you go to the Empire State Building, you just drop people off it. It's fair, apparently like a big.
Ooh, I like
thing.
That. I like that a little bit. But you know what? I'm with the kids. I'm with the kids on the left called multi-tendency. So I'm open to a lot of different things.
Just do it economically.
I'm now picturing Brandon like shot putting people off the Empire State Building.
No. People will clip this and be like, "You see, they're admitting it."
Also, comedy's back, baby. The comedy's back, so they can't even. This is comedy, my friend.
Legalized comedy.
Yeah.
Kowalski, did you notice what shirt Brandon was wearing?
I have not been able to watch the program today. I've been listening.
Well, he's got the KFFI shirt on.
Well, that's because he's a real one. That's also camouflage. If you're traveling through the rural parts of the Midwest, like they'll tip their red hats to you. It's fine.
Top of the morning to you.
So I would love to give you guys some agricultural news, but it's fine. You're going to be fine. Instead, I thought something entertaining I would bring to your mind. What is your guys' position on the Liver King wanting to fight Joe Rogan to the death?
I heard about this.
Have you been
they arrested him?
Yeah,
he was actually going to Austin. Like they caught him on the way there.
Hmm. I mean, road rage is a real problem. A lot of people don't like to talk about it because they don't, you know, it's a silent addiction, especially in a combat sports dominated culture, online bodybuilding dominated culture. So, you know, just be aware.
I'm guessing
steroid abuse to the point that you're red in the face 24/7 might not be good for your mental health.
Right.
Also,
possibly some sort of parasite from all that raw meat he was eating.
who do you have in that fight?
Be a worm though? In that who, brain, like with RFK.
Who do you think would have won? Oh yeah, definitely probably has brain parasites from eating all of like the offal. But like, who do you think would have won that fight? I think Joe Rogan would have won that fight pretty easily.
Oh yeah, interesting. I don't know. I don't know Liver King's sort of height and reach, but
he seems like one of those
really
guys.
Much faith in Rogan these days, but
I think Rogan's also
mine would be on the Liver King. I think he's deranged enough. It's like fighting a honey badger on methamphetamine. Like, yeah, you got the mass, yeah. But they don't feel pain.
Right. Yeah, he might have been like out of control. Like he might have won through like just biting, like literally like tearing
desperation, yeah.
Through skin with his teeth on Rogan, right.
I don't know. I think Rogan's just been around like martial arts enough, and Liver King, by nature of how muscular he is just not very like flexible, probably.
Right. That,
like,
yeah,
I think if Joe Rogan was able to like survive the initial blitz and onslaught, like if he was able to survive the initial like Tasmanian devil-esque like rage tornado that was the Liver King, he'd be able to like choke him out pretty easily because he'd be so like worked up. His cardio is probably not very good from the steroids and like all the meat. So like I think that like if the first onslaught is survived, Joe Rogan has it. If not, you know, then obviously Liver King, I guess, eats his liver. I don't know what he was going to do.
Anything else, Kowalski, before we let you
know? No, I'm glad I was able to accomplish basically nothing with this call. I am very glad to see that Mondami, or however I'm supposed to be saying it, I don't know.
What are you, Andrew Cuomo over here? Andrew Cuomo could never get the name down. Even in his concession speech, he said his name wrong. It's amazing. What are you, Cuomo?
It's Samler.
Hey, don't be rude to Italians. You know they can't pronounce words without using their hands. That's very insensitive.
Right. There's a lot of things they apparently can't do without using their hands, and that's what got Andrew Cuomo in trouble. Oh! All right. Have a good
one. Entire concession speech without groping a single woman, which is progress. You have to give him props for that.
I recall that. He actually said, like, at least that famous Chiron, which was 100% real. That when he was defending himself, he said he wasn't a pervert. He's just Italian. We kiss, we talk, we touch. Yeah, maybe that's why he lost some Italian some you know, traditionally Italian areas of New York. Maybe they were just like, hey, we're not getting behind the pervert who called us perverts.
Yeah, I don't think it's Italian custom to sue for the gynecological records of the women that are accusing you of touching them up.
Right.
That's more like a South Italy God, thing.
Probably not.
Just like my nonna did. Have a great day.
All right. You all have a good one. Have a very happy 4th of July. You guys are the most patriotic podcast on the internet these days.
We are patriots. Absolutely. Well, I mean, and I do want to contradict Kowalski because he actually did accomplish something with that call, which is a segue in us right into another clip, which is somebody who two guys who I think would beat the Liver King and Joe Rogan if this was sort of a tag team thing. It's Dr. Mike from Renaissance Periodization and Dr. Abdul El Sayed, who has been a guest on the show a couple of times and wrote the book on why we should do Medicare for All. So here is Dr. Abdul El Sayed and Dr. Mike talking about fitness.
All right, we're here in what is probably the most iconic, epic home gym ever with Dr. Mike Israetel. We're about to get a workout. We're doing some chest. We're doing some shoulders. I know I'm about to be in a lot of pain. Dr. Mike, I really appreciate
it.
You.
Let's
Thank you so much for
Let's
opening your home
Let's
gym to
it.
Us.
Suffering begins. Two more.
Some chest flies.
Big chest.
Little cable flies.
Chest up. Okay. Chest up. Chest up. Chest up. Pause. Good. More.
Show me the weight.
Chest up.
Now, Brandon, I've actually been doing chest flies. I like them for the chest more than even like bench press. Some. What's your opinion on this sort of exercise that we're seeing?
Oh, I love good cable fly. It's a staple of a chest workout. I wouldn't use it to replace bench pressing, but you know, it's definitely great for like filling out and getting a nice wide, especially when you do it like he's doing, which is properly, which is you're getting a good arch in your arms when you're going back and forth. It gives you a nice like wide, like thick chest. People like that.
Yep.
Chest up. Rack. Good stuff.
Young men in particular are facing a crisis of purpose. Okay. I think you have huge corporations that have figured out how to game people's dopamine receptors in some really problematic ways.
You get a lot of personal stories. What we can say confidently is that for lots of people, there is a crisis. Every human life matters. Prosperity matters, and flourishing matters. So I think on the topic of young men who have maybe don't have much purpose, I'll tell you this, I've been through the entire educational system here in the state of Michigan. Not ever once were we taught purpose. Maybe that's for the best politically that it's not on the curriculum, because like if the conservatives are in control, your purpose is going to be to, you know, insert conservative shit. Leftists are in control, it's going to be leftist shit. Some of it lands really well, some of it doesn't land at all. But you have to go get purpose somewhere else. And I think my best concept of what modern purpose can look like is this. There are problems in the world, and we can probably solve like all of them. But there's like, you know, 99 problems and one solution relative so far. Mm. Like so many things we could be doing better. Like homelessness still exists. There are people who grow up in broken homes and don't have anyone to mentor them. There's people somewhere, other parts of the world that don't have enough to eat. So my message to young men would be, we need your help to solve all of the world's problems. And so and there's this whole idea of like, well, you know, we've been, you know, certain groups have been kind of fronted and promoted for too long. That's all nonsense. So for everyone, I think a good construct of purpose is make yourself better through exercise, through studying, through diligent inspection of philosophy, so that you become a more capable person. Big chest, pause.
So, you know, I mean, Dr. Mike is not a political guy, so he did the right and the left thing there. But I actually really like that answer for what this is the real crisis for young men. It's not that women or gay people or whatever get like more representation in media. It's that the actual meaning of life is bleached out of any of the messaging that you get through these corporate structures, which is to deal with all these problems that we see just lying around us. Why do we have a lack of housing? Why do we have people going bankrupt because of medicine? And these are all things that are civilizationally important, but also like tasks for a life. And instead we're told, buy the right Bitcoin or what, like figure out a way to invest in GameStop. Like this is a joke.
No, absolutely. And I like that part too. And I think it's so important, especially when you engage in more explicitly political media, right? To not fall into the trap that I think a lot of people who do, you know, operate in these spaces fall into, of believing that people who don't make explicitly political content aren't going out there and trying to make sense of the world using the tools that they have. In fact, everyone is doing that all the time, and not just people who are making content, the people who are, you know, walking around that you pass on the street. They're all trying to figure out how the world works, you know, how different phenomenon impacting their life function. But people are naturally curious and naturally going to do that. That's why we've had to, you know, and by we, I mean our government and the people and the businesses that control it, have had to work to strip away the tools that people used to have, or at least have access to, that would allow them to interpret what they're seeing around them in a way that, like, situates it properly in its historical context, its structural context, its, you know, systemic context. So that the best thing that you can expect from people, I think, is things that, like, Dr. Mike is saying there, which is that, like, you know, I see all these things around me. I see all of this injustice. I see all of this desperation. I see all this alienation. And I just want to, like, empower people, and just not realizing that, like, personal empowerment, self-empowerment, individual's empowerment is just limited. And it's not utility per se, but in its ability to generate the kinds of wide sweeping changes that we need to make as a society. Yes, you know, in a perfect world, if everyone was Clark Kent, there wouldn't need to be a Superman, right? But from a practical standpoint, it's not as easy to get everyone to personally improve themselves the way he's talking about as it is to change society from the top down using governmental structures, using agencies, using incentives in the world to, like, incentivize and encourage people to have this kind of behavior in a holistic sense. You know, ideally, from the moment they become formally educated in society, they would start being trained to have these kinds of, you know, this kind of self-esteem, these kinds of drives that would, like, you know, counteract what we're seeing now. Because, like, I agree with what he's saying, but the reality is that, like, you know, there is a limit to how many people you can even reach with this message, no matter how popular you are as a YouTuber, versus, like, if you actually create the systems and you create the circumstances that would lead to the kind of behavior that you want to see in people, you incentivize that behavior and you ensure it happens in, you know, at the societal level.
100%. Like, all the crypto stuff and all, like, the sports betting and basically money for nothing type of stuff is a direct a sort of outgrowth of decades and decades of neoliberal policy that says the only thing is the market and making a profit. It's not, like, what you actually make, how you actually change society. It's, can you make your number go up?
Yeah, and people also just not feeling like there are any legitimate pathways to accumulating the kind of wealth that they think they need to live a successful life. And obviously, we've seen that amount of money that people think they need, especially Gen Zers versus previous generations, go up to, like, astronomically. But in reality, the amount that you do need to survive at this day and age, you know, to live, to not just survive but thrive, is astronomical compared to what it used to be. It may not be what Gen Zers think it is, but, like, we've seen the average cost of, like, a family house rise $100,000, I think, over the past decade.
Yeah.
I see some people in the chat talking about how he has, he does have, like, a socio-political YouTube channel as well as his workout stuff. And he's a bit, on the out there libertarian side of things a lot of times.
Oh, but yeah.
Yeah. I think it's not a surprise. Yeah. But also, it's good to see that apparently he did a workout video with Hassan or something too. And
that's
here he
I
is with
first, yeah.
Abdul Saeed. You know, I think having people like this who are willing to have these discussions is good. And I think, you know, I don't think he said anything that in terms of you know, the crisis that young men are currently going through. I don't think he said anything that is revealing to the three of us. But what I think is interesting is that what he said, it was coming from a guy like him. And I think if more people are saying things like that, you know, perhaps more young men will actually deal with what's actually going on.
He should have me on to Lyft. He should, you know,
yes,
I'm always going to Lyft.
Yeah.
And I will say, like, I think it's again, this is about the limits to people's ability to perceive the entirety of a situation from their positionality unless they are actively, like, and, you know, and again, I have to say, our society, he said he's been educated his entire life in Michigan, you know, then he's in the educated in the United States education system. So we just have to admit that our formal education system does not work to engender a sense of like critical empathy in people, the ability to like see yourself in people's position if you don't like have some kind of direct connection to them racially, religiously, nationality speaking. So, you know, I'm not surprised that he recognizes a desperation of crisis of a desperation crisis in young men. There's a desperation crisis in every demographic, except for maybe the uber wealthy, except if, you know, now that Zohran has been nominated as the Democratic Party nominee in the mayoral, it's just a lot of anxiety there too. But like for him, someone who makes content that likely attracts a young male audience overwhelmingly, it's hyper visible to him that it's young men who are experiencing this form of desperation. Not to mention all of the, you know, the school shootings that tend to over index on young men. But I bet if we spoke to like maybe more libertarian or uwu leaning like women's content creator, they would be able to tell us that there's a crisis with young women too. And you know, I think there's like a whole picture here that people aren't seeing, which is that like there is widespread social alienation that is causing people to feel as though they are being isolated from their communities. And you know, that's causing just different flare-ups and different manifestations.
All right. Let's take one more call, and then I want to get to this Charlie Kirk video to end the show. This is the highlight of the sound sheet, and I really want to get to
mature student Charlie Kirk.
Yes. So
I said
non-traditional student.
I just think that he should, like, he didn't finish community college, and I don't think a degree is the end all be all, but he just spends so much time on college campuses that I just feel like he might as well at least audit a class, at least just like maybe audit a WIGS, women and gender sexuality studies, like 201 class, like just sit there and like, you know, you don't have to go to school. I'm not trying to advocate. It's not for everybody, but to me, it would be like if somebody came to the gym every day and tried to argue people out of working out after having given up after 2 weeks, but they came every day to do it. Like, just lift something. Like, see, maybe just try again. Maybe try again.
Right. You know what? Maybe we should just skip the call right now and get right to it. Let's play this clip of Charlie Kirk, who is obviously very upset that Zohran Mamdani has won the mayoral Democratic primary in New York City. So much so that he immediately took to Twitter after Mamdani's victory to say some of the most racist, vile, xenophobic, Islamophobic crap you've ever seen, saying how he can't believe that just decades, 20 some odd years after 9/11, New York City would elect a Muslim. This is the grossest shit imaginable that, of course, never gets called out. But Mamdani shows some empathy for Palestinians. And all of a sudden you have every single media outlet declaring him anti-Semitic and asking him if he'll visit Israel and allow Israel to remain the one the Jewish state to exist. Here's Charlie Kirk on Zohran Mamdani.
Perfect example of so many different forces happening in our country. And it goes to show that our debate around immigration is not just about the southern border. Securing our southern border is very important. And President Trump deserves hero's praise on a repeated and daily basis for what he has been able to do on the southern border. No one is coming across the border. Zero is the only number that President Trump puts up with on the southern border. And he deserves so much praise for that and how quickly and effectively he's been able to do that. But let's be honest, everybody. That issue, as long as President Trump or J.D. Vance are president, that issue is settled and solved. This is not about a southern border issue. It's about deportations, but it's actually about something even more immediate. Mr. Zohran Kwame Mamdani, he came here illegally. And now he is a U.S. citizen. Did we make the right choice? It's time for us to have an honest and open conversation about this. Was that a good move? Is this guy currently trying to make America better? Is he the best that we could possibly bring in? Zohran Kwame Mamdani. He wants to destroy New York City. He literally wants to defund the police. Every person that we naturalize as a citizen in this country should come with the question, does this person make America better or worse? And Mamdani is a perfect example of worse. Do we want more people in America named after African dictators? Well, you can't choose your name, but it should make you press pause. Is Mamdani assimilating? When he came to this country, is he assimilated to our values? He's trying to globalize the Intifada.
That's
what he said. We need to globalize the Intifada, which means to globalize terrorism. He wants to sanction the state of Israel. He said that he will arrest Netanyahu if he comes to New York for a UN.
That was the best policy I heard from
his mom. Says cut 4-7.
Yeah, can I just remind folks, and Brandon, if you can refresh there, we lost your video, but New Yorkers voted in this election. They knew all of this stuff, and they rewarded him for those positions, including when the International Criminal Court has a goddamn warrant out for war crimes. You don't just let that person traipse through your city like Eric Adams does. I'm so disgusted that Itamar Ben-Gavir was in my goddamn neighborhood this year. It is like one of the most sickening feelings I've had, that he just gets to clown around with his fascists as they beat up like women who are just passersby in the street. That is a menace, and we should have a mayor that is willing to stand up for it. And by the way, he also said the same thing. He would not honor Modi either because of his Gujarati background. So this is not a fixation on Israel. The person who's fixated on Israel is a guy like Charlie Kirk, who is willing to throw over all of the things that he described as truths several months ago, such as any strikes in Iran are a horrible idea. Well, now that Daddy Trump did it, Charlie Kirk comes running back, and his audience was not for those strikes. And so now how do you make up for the fact that you've been basically exposed as in the bag for Trump in Israel? Is you double down on being Islamophobic.
Right. It's amazing to, it's not shocking or anything. Of course they're going to go here. I mean, but this is some like really old school. Like this is what we saw in 2008 with Obama, the Barack Hussein Obama. They would always have to say his full name, extra oomph on the Hussein part. He's doing the same shit. Zohran Kwame Mamdani. Like, who gives a shit? Everyone knows his full name. In fact, unlike Obama, Zohran is double downing on his full name because he's proud of it, like he should be. And he puts his full name, Zohran Kwame Mamdani, in his social media profiles for his name. Like, this is a guy that you're not surprising anyone with. This isn't a guy with some like a radical preacher's church that he went to back in the day, and now he's trying to downplay it. No, this is a guy who stands by every single thing that Charlie Kirk is trying to hit him for, as if it's some sort of big shocking surprise to people. No, Zohran Kwame Mamdani ran on all these issues, and he won. And not only did he win, he won with a mandate. So much so that Andrew Cuomo, the guy who thought he was going to fight for till the end for this race, doesn't even see a lane for himself anymore after the first round of ranked choice voting.
It's also funny that they're like, you know, doing the Barack Hussein Obama thing again, because Barack Hussein Obama won that election.
He's
the most popular politician of our lifetime.
Exactly. So, like, I mean, that's not to say Islamophobia doesn't exist in our country. It's just to say that, like, you know, this one is you lost this one, guys. You lost this one. I know they're circling the drain on this one. They're crashing out pretty hard, but like, you know, it was a wash.
Yeah, I want to put up this tweet here. This is and get Mason's full tweet in there too. This is at One Hand Politics. Charlie Kirk basically got into this debate with Jessica Tarlov, who responded saying, "Charlie, this is so gross and Islamophobic. Take it down." And Charlie said, "Debate me on the merits. Just don't just throw out petty thought terminating cliches." Now, I want to talk to the young men particularly on this. The young men who talk about logical fallacies, put us all up, who think that they're getting some sort of logic mastery when they listen to someone like Charlie Kirk. As Mason points out here, Debate me on the merits. You just equated a Muslim state legislator with Al-Qaeda. But there is a certain sort of type of young man that when they hear Charlie Kirk put out a vocabulary term like thought-terminating cliches, they're like, oh, he's actually got him there. No, a thought-terminating cliche is not pointing out that Charlie Kirk is a racist, because that's just true. The thought-terminating cliche is to say anybody who's standing up against Israel is a terror supporter. Like, that is your thought-terminating cliche there. And Charlie Kirk relies on those exclusively. So, look, depending on the merits are, Charlie, that you are paid to support whatever America and its vassal state, Israel, a client state slash aircraft carrier, Israel want. And you will do that. And the one of the key ways this has always been done is through racism.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, there are no merits to his argument because his argument relies on the internalized Islamophobia of his audience to make any kind of sense, right? You know, peppered in with just like lies about the demographics of New York City. I can't remember if it was him or Matt Walsh who was like fear mongering over the fact that New York City is now like 40%-ish like immigrant or non-native New Yorker occupied. And it's like, it's always been that way. Right. Like, that's always been the demographic of New York City because it's the city of immigrants in the United States of America. So, I mean, these people are like struggling to cope with the reality that their brand of fear mongering, at least in this one particular instance, just didn't work. But I'm sure they will be using Zohran's name, like we've already seen, to like fundraise, to scare their elderly audience into sending them their rapidly dwindling Social Security. And, you know, it'll work for that.
Right. They're going to go full on like, you remember the last time we warned you about the Muslim from Africa? Well, we were lying then. He wasn't Muslim or from Africa. But now there is one. There's actually a Muslim from Africa.
This one's like, extra that's... Muslim. He's instituting Islamo-communism in New York City.
Right.
Also, who has a large foreign-born population is Houston. Don't hear so much about that. And it's so funny when like people who are from like cities like Nashville or like St. Louis, cities with like frankly extremely high gun crime and violent crime rates, think that New York is unsafe. Bro, New York is very safe for how many people live here.
You know what other place has a really high foreign-born population? Israel.
Oh yeah.
Checkmate.
And then he's like, what Muslim country do you prefer to live in? Like, I don't want to live in a Jewish one either, Charlie. I don't want to live in ethno states. Thanks. And I don't want to make this one either, unlike your, gummy ass.
Yeah, these are the guys always claiming this is a Christian nation, right?
Sucks.
Right. Is there anything else worth listening to in that clip? Does he say anything else stupid?
Okay, I'm sure the whole thing a little bit more, I suppose, yeah.
75, quote, he is total desi, completely. He's not Faranis at all. Again, this is all like Indian talk.
Indian talk? Oh, he's my God. Wait, what?
This is what we're talking about. We were talking about this before because it's like they don't know, okay, should we go after him because of the Indian thing, the Africa thing, the socialist thing, the Muslim thing?
He's short-circuiting like, them. Like, yeah, he's too many things.
It's a two-target-rich environment. He's flooding the zone with all of his identities.
They can't even finish a sentence. That like the amount of racism that they're trying to process in their brains is like short-circuiting them. It's like it's overloading their CPU. Like they just can't handle it. Like he's like frothing and turning red. He just goes like, he's African. He's Muslim. He's Muslim. He's African. Uganda and liberal socialist. And I
can't believe he crashed out on seeing the word Desi. He actually crashed out. He was like, Indian stuff!
He's an Islamist who's also radically pro-gay and trans.
Bro, completely. It'll be all right. It's going to be all right, bro. Just put on Kabi Kushi Kabi Gam. Put on DDLJ. You know, dedicate next 7 hours of your life to some of the best music you've ever experienced, some of the prettiest locations, prettiest, you know, people, and just let it happen. Like let Shahrukh happen to you. Like it is fine.
He is total desi, completely. He's not Farangis at all. Again, this is all like Indian talk. He is very much us. He's not American at all. He was born in Uganda, raised between India and America. He's at home in many places. He thinks of himself as a Ugandan, as an Indian, Nair told us during a recent visit to the Capitol. So he's Indian, not Western. Just fine. You have a right to be Indian. You're trying to be the mayor of America's largest city. I would like for you to be American.
Bro, you don't even go here.
Zoran derangement syndrome.
Where does Charlie broadcast from?
Certainly not New York City, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, it is the America's greatest city. It's because your ass and people like you are fucking afraid of it. Stay the fuck away.
Yeah. No,
trying to run America's largest metropolis. It'd be good if you knew something about this place and you loved us. This is not like the mayor
us. You get like Matt said, you don't go here. What do you mean us? In fact, I bet if you search Charlie Kirk's like social media history or look at the transcripts for all his podcasts, I'm sure Charlie Kirk has knocked you, the New York City, the liberal blue state, more so than anything Zoran has ever said about New York in even a critical way. Give me a break.
And so, also, he's been here since he was seven.
So according to Wikipedia, it seems like Charlie Kirk lives in like Phoenix, Arizona. I don't know if he's moved recently to New York City, but he lives in the heat dome. Like you got other things to worry about. Don't worry about how hot New York City politics are. Worry about how hot it literally is where you are. Just don't worry about it.
Keokuk, Iowa.
Cuck?
He's not the mayor of Fort Collins, Colorado.
Yeah, I don't care.
He's name dropping small cities, it sounds like.
Okay, cool.
America's largest metropolis. It'd be good if you knew something about this place and you loved us. This is not like the mayor of
us.
You're not Iowa. He's not the mayor of Fort Collins, Colorado. And I hope you guys don't have Islamists running those cities.
Yeah. I was going to say, would you be fine if it was?
They should.
Running those cities. No, New York City is the beacon of the entire West.
You're right, Billy.
You think of America, you think of New York City. As John Lennon said, it is the center of the world.
As John Lennon said.
Not an American guy.
And they try to stop you from talking about this. Again, last night someone tried to stop me from talking this on Twitter. They said, oh, you're an Islamophobe. It's like, it's a thought terminating cliche. And I have voted.
Who taught him thought terminating cliche? That's so funny. No, it is just true because you're a psycho race fixated moron, Charlie.
The Republican like influencers got that term installed in the last like firmware update. They've been using it.
Or Abe Hamid. They really
love to like take 9/11. This is what he's talking about. His disgusting 9/11 tweet. They really love to take it as if it's something like they experienced too. Like they like Charlie Kirk in Phoenix, Arizona, however old he was on 9/11. Like he was under attack and he saw the smoke and he had family members or someone who his family knew anywhere in New York City and was worried about them. You are just like biting off of people who actually went through like a horrific experience and came out a better person than you even after they actually experienced it. And don't blame anyone who looks different from themselves on what happened that day. You learned nothing from this because you had nothing to do with it. So get the fuck out of here. Get the fuck out of here.
I mean, from talking to this on Twitter, they said, oh, you're an Islamophobe. It's like, it's a thought terminating cliche. And I have voted for a Muslim before, Abe Hamadeh. I've supported Muslim Abe Hamadeh. I've endorsed Zudi Jasser. My primary care doctor is Muslim. It has nothing to do with that. I'm not even going to play that game.
You just did.
And I got in a dispute with Jessica Tarlov, if you guys know who that is. Whatever.
He's so mad.
He's so pissed.
And you guys can read my response. I thought my response was actually very good.
Oh, yeah.
Very thoughtful.
Oh, wow.
And I asked the question, what Western city, name it, has gotten better the more Islamic that it's become?
London.
And then one of the guys in the replies said, Doha. Okay, that's not a Western city. That is that is the capital of Qatar. Another guy said, well, Abu Dhabi is really nice. Again, that's in the Emirates. By the way, just so we know, Doha is getting less Muslim as they import more labor from Africa to go do the work of the ruling class of Qatar. Oh, wow. Is London better? Is Paris better? Is Amsterdam better? Is Berlin better?
All these are great cities that none of Charlie Kirk's audience will go to because like barely any of them have passports. And it's like, yeah, fine, don't go to London. I very much enjoyed London being there. You know who the problem with London and the problem with Paris is? The rich people who pay for Charlie Kirk to talk shit online all day.
Also, the mayor of, well, I mean, I guess he's saying Amsterdam has become more Islamist, but I was like, the mayor of Amsterdam is not Islamic, I don't think.
Yeah, no, I think he just means like it's his replacement theories or stuff. This is Europe's committing suicide by allowing refugees sort of stuff. This is people looking at demographics and being absolutely hysterical that there are less white people being born than brown people.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I think when things like this happen, we're also always talking about the psychosocial, yes, but also psychosexual obsession of the far right, in the sense that seeing a brown person take a position of power just makes them and the people who watch their content feel less valuable. It makes them feel like, well, I'm not the mayor of New York. I'm not doing this. Like, how does this implicate me? And so, like, you know, that kind of white grievance policy, I mean, politics is, you know, deeply ingrained in the kind of content that Charlie Kirk is pushing onto his, like, audience. And then also, obviously, he's just afraid for the same reason a lot of, you know, people in political media are afraid, because he knows these things are going to be successful and popular. He knows that he's successful and popular. And, you know, ideologically, we're, you know, opposed.
Better. Mm-hmm. Is any one of these places in Europe? And it's not a matter of being racist. All that stuff is dumb. I don't do that. This is not 2015. Your little weird voodoo mind trick doesn't work anymore. You think you see this little mentalist?
No, it's going to work, Charlie.
Where they come up to you and they could just say like a bunch of magic words. It's like the Harry Potter thing.
He is melting
down.
They
could just kind of do a little magic.
Expecto racismo.
Warped. They're like paralyzed. Doesn't work that way anymore. Ooh, you're in a
you're, you're paralyzed in a different way. You can't stop talking about it because you're so fucking messed up because she called you out for being racist. Oh my God, that's so funny. I'm not paralyzed. Yeah, you're not paralyzed. Like, you're not like Wile E. Coyote watching the train come to hit you. You keep rambling and rambling and rambling about it because you can't get it out of your mind.
He's paralyzed by his own racism. Like, you know, right. I know that racism and bigotry is not a mental illness, but certainly some people on the right have turned it into one for themselves. Like he's having this incredibly emotional, like, freak out about, like, he's not even the mayor yet, guys. That's the real sign that this is going to only get worse. Like, he's not even the mayor yet. He didn't even win the general election and they're already acting like this. Good. I mean, they're right to be upset. They're right to be hysterical. I think if anything, they should be more upset.
Doesn't work that way anymore. Ooh, you're an Islamophobe. Okay, I'll stop talking. Yeah, that doesn't work, okay? Trump destroyed that entire paradigm. Thank you, Donald Trump.
Okay.
I kind of disagree, and we'll stop it there, but I think Trump may have actually... I think wokeness is, in Charlie Kirk's terminology, this whole, like, oh, we actually don't like racism, I think that stuff is going to come back, Charlie. I think it is going to arise for the same reason it arose the first time, which is that... when the American people see the Republicans in power beyond just them saying, oh, Democrats can't do anything, which is true, they see the like heinous bigotry and react negatively to it.
Oh, for sure. More people are going to be canceled under Donald Trump's presidencies than were ever canceled under Joe Biden or Barack Obama, for sure. Because the right wing is, you know, incredibly emotional and incredibly sensitive, and they're the ones who mostly lead these witch hunts, and they're going to start eating each other, especially over this schism that's arising over Iran, over Israel, over, you know, who's being funded by whom.
Here's the clip on Modi. Oh crap, this isn't the full one, never mind. Actually, before I get to that, here is actually a different clip. This is you guys familiar with Avalon Emerson? She's an electronic musician who I've liked for a while. Got great stuff. I like her a lot more now that she did a sort of remix of the moment that Zoran Kwame Mamdani called out Cuomo for mispronouncing his name. And she posted this to her Instagram. This is a quote tweet of Jeremy Flood, _ Floodlight on Twitter.
To Mr. Cuomo, I have never had to resign in disgrace. I have never cut Medicaid. I have never stolen hundreds of millions of dollars from the MTA. I have never hounded the 13 women who credibly accused me of sexual harassment. I have never sued for their gynecological records. And I have never done those things because I am not you, Mr. Cuomo. And furthermore, the name is Mamdani. M-A-M-D-A-N-I. You should learn how to say it.
Wow. That's great. That's awesome.
No, that's great. That's yeah. great. That was a great moment too. I love how he dragged his name through the mud.
I agree. I think it's an important one. Like, I think when socialists when people say, and I think it's probably a little bit reductive that Bernie didn't have sort of the killer instinct when he ran against the Democrats, but he never did anything quite like that, where you go at the heart of the credibility of the person that you're up against, and in part because Bernie's a team player, and you know it. Whatever, but I think you do need to do this in order to signal to the wider voting public that you're serious and you're not going to pull a punch here. Here's the thing I was talking about. He was at a mayoral candidate sort of get together with Brad Lander here, and there was a question about Narendra Modi, and I think this is an extremely just good answer. And this is a guy who understands world politics really well.
President Narendra Modi, and this will go to you first.
Come on.
Lander of India.
I was supposed to get Netanyahu and he was supposed to get Modi. Didn't you even get the memo?
Get all of them. So
Modi is holding a rally in Madison Square Garden. He wants to hold a joint press conference with you afterwards, reaffirming the strong bond between India and New York. Do you agree to the event?
No.
All right, Mr. Stringer?
No.
And Mr. Mamdani?
No, and I just want to say something here, which is that my father, his family comes from Gujarat in India, and his family is Muslim. I'm Muslim. And Narendra Modi helped to orchestrate what was a mass slaughter of Muslims in Gujarat to the extent that we don't even believe there are Gujarati Muslims anymore. And when I tell someone that I am, it's a shock to them that is even the case. And this is someone who we should view in the same manner that we do Benjamin Netanyahu. This is a war criminal.
That's good.
Yeah.
Why does he hate Israel so much?
And I guarantee you, most people who's unlike Netanyahu, this is just how it is. A lot of people in the U.S. are probably unfamiliar with Modi and India's political landscape, and they will walk away learning the baseline stuff from that conversation with that Mamdani had on that stage.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I think it's hard for a lot of Americans to come to terms with the fact that, you know, a lot of the people you see shaking hands with the president are like war criminals, guilty of human rights violations. I would say, you know, most, if not all of them are, but sometimes they meet with like, I don't know, a tribal chief from like a smaller countries. And so it doesn't happen all the time, technically. But like, yeah, you know, seeing Trump shake hands with, Mohammed bin Salman, seeing them sit down with Modi, seeing them sit down with Netanyahu, that should not like engender a sense of trust in that other person. It should, you know, make you distrust our president even more.
100%.
Yeah. All right, folks. It's already, 2:45. Let me read some IMs and, that's the show. Let's see. Any thoughts on Bernie on Joe Rogan recently? Asks Bingo Dango.
We'll do a clip tomorrow of Bernie and Joe talking about climate change, and you'll be shocked that Joe didn't have all the facts that he claimed to have at his disposal.
Right. Tom Cotton's Beard says the right wing and lib freak out alone makes Zoran winning the primary worth it. Yeah, I mean, it's I haven't seen the right this racist in a while. I mean, they're always very racist, but this is like hyper drive racism. It's been a while.
Nightmare.
I'm actually concerned for their health. They're so racist right now. I'm concerned that like you're going to see a lot of like hogs like making those like front facing, you know, vertical camera videos in their cars, and they're going to be halfway through like mispronouncing Zoran's name, and then they're going to grab their chest, and their face is going to turn all red, and it's going to like collapse. And I think that's just going to be like, it's sad. It's sad. Right. Racism.
Zoran Mamdani is going to cause a lot of right-wing aneurysms, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah.
DSA Aaron in Atlanta says, Zoran literally passed the test to become a citizen. He knows more about America than Charlie. I mean, that's the truth with a lot of people who have to take those citizenship tests. They know more about America than these people who were born in America, like Charlie Kirk, because they didn't have to take any tests. They just the privilege of being born here. They don't have to learn anything about the country and its history. Let's see. Lavender Allergy says, so the soy right is literally saying your anti-racism hasn't aged well, sweetie. I mean, they're like Lex said, they're in for a rude awakening in just a few short years, honestly. I'm seeing it. Like, people are not liking this stuff that the right thinks they can do now. Richard Marxist says, Binder represents NYC with that the fuck out of here. Right. Give me a break. I hate this. All of a sudden, these true American patriots who hate everything there is about the liberal coasts, especially that liberal bash in New York City, all of a sudden become super New York lovers when they bring up 9/11 or some shit. I love it.
I think that gives up the game and gives up their true anxiety so much more than anything else, because they hate New York. The Republicans, people like Charlie Kirk, they can never say enough negative things about New York. If they really thought electing Zoran to be the mayor of New York would destroy New York and make socialism look bad, they would be championing it. They would be clapping their hands at the from the rooftops. They would love it. But they don't think that. They think that it's going to normalize leftist politics, which is going to, you know, abnormalize their politics.
All right. Cognitive Dissident says, Desi Arnaz, he's Cuban too. I mean, honestly, back maybe just a couple months ago, being Cuban would be one of the things the right would like about Mamdani if he was Cuban. But now they're ready to send even the Cubans down to Miami back to Cuba under Trump's immigration crackdown.
It's wet foot now.
Yeah. Tim Pool's Plunger says Kirk is not what conservatives should stand for. David Horowitz is rolling over in his grave. Hopeful One says, could Kirk at least quote him correctly? It's not even what Mamdani said. Are you talking about like the globalized the Antifada thing? Right. People keep saying he said, Zohar Mamdani never even said globalize the Antifada. He was asked about that chant that other people say. And he simply said he wouldn't say it himself, because that's not like something what he says, but he says he understands the people who do say it, and that his understanding of the meaning is not what, you know, these Zionists try to claim it means.
Yeah, and he also said like he's not here to police slogans of activists, which is you know, very welcome.
Yeah. Right. And also, it's good to like turn that back on them. Like, what are you, language police? Like, you know, I thought jokes were legal. I thought, you know, freedom of speech was the law of the land now. Like, so why do you care what people are saying? Like, mind your business.
Texas Leftist says, hitting that middle name like Barack Hussein Obama. Right. He was doing the same inflection with his voice and everything. It was incredible. Zoran Kwame Mamdani. It was just, they can't help themselves.
From Uganda. Mm.
Yeah. Ooh. Desi. Oh, that's some Indian shit, he said. Oh, my God. I can't get over that. Biden My Time says, maybe Curtis Siwa's beret can run as an independent. Right. Biden My Time also says, Curtis Siwa's time has come. Yeah. I hope they get behind him and Eric Adams and all these guys, because they're under a completely different plane of reality if they think these guys are going to beat Zoran.
Yeah, they should form one big delusional ticket.
Right. Brooklyn PD, how about Jamal Bowman primaries Chuck Schumer? Haven't heard talk of this, but I think it would be a great choice. No, I don't think Bowman's the guy for that. I think Bowman should look at Richie Torres' district.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think Bowman's the guy, unfortunately.
AOC's the Senate pick.
Yeah. And if Bowman's not going to primary Torres, then I think Michael Blake is someone who should look at that too. He was the other guy who cross-endorsed Zoran Mamdani. And he actually ran in 2020 against Richie Torres when Richie Torres won that seat. And it was a really big field, a lot of candidates that all split the vote. and Michael Blake came in second. So, I mean, he should maybe relook at that if Bowman's not going to.
Yeah, I actually ranked Blake. I didn't trust him because he seemed like an Obama guy, at least when I first looked at his bio. But look, you win points with me if you decide to play ball. And in the final weeks of the race, he started paying for anti-Cuomo ads and doing this whole don't rank Cuomo thing. And so I ranked him fourth after Myrie, who I also have problems with, but who did the exact same thing. And that's what, you know, you need to see. And I had to rank Adrian Adams fifth because even despite the weird stuff about finances from Cuomo, because, you know, I just felt like five was what was right. Asked for by Zoran.
Anyone but Cuomo, right. Make sure it was stopped at all fronts. Also, I would 100%, even if Michael Blake was the most hardcore Obama guy today, I would vote for the Obama guy over Richie Torres, who is literally a Trump guy now. Like, he could pretend he's not all he wants. The way he's lock and step with Israel, there's no way you can be that pro-Israel and not be a MAGA guy at this point. And the final I am of the day, let's see. Between the 101 and the 5 says AOC for Senate. Bowman takes her congressional seat if he's able to move there. Well, I don't think Bowman's right for her district either. But he doesn't even have to move there. He is, you can run for Congress as long as you live in the state. He doesn't have to live in the district. But AOC should definitely look at running for Senate for sure. Yeah, I think that's the way to go about it. And, you enjoy my socialism says, if Michael Blake doesn't get primarying Torres, Mamdani's army will go to the Bronx to canvass for him. Whoever runs, and I honestly think the most, we keep focusing on Richie Torres, and I think that will be a fight worth having, and it'll be one that could definitely go in our favor. But the most obvious one is Daniel Goldman. That seat is Brad Landers if he wants it. He literally lives in the district. The district voted for him in numbers for this mayoral primary. He is way more well-liked than Daniel Goldman is. He is the guy. It would be a near sure thing. Like 99% Brad Lander would knock Daniel Goldman out of that seat. He just has to say he wants to do it. And that Zoran Mamdani army will be there to help him do it. I mean, that's the most sure thing. Yes.
I live in Goldman's district, and it disgusts me. Absolutely.
Oh my God.
I don't even think you could even call it a fight. I think it would literally be just like, you do the work and it's done. Just do the work, hit the ground like you did for Zoran, and it's a done deal. No even biting your nails on election night like we did, a couple nights ago or in a race against Torres. This would be like the most sure thing if the work is done for Brad Lander.
Did you see that Ayaan Hirsi Ali is putting forth Bill Ackman to run as an independent the mayor?
We talked about it earlier. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Ackman. I don't think he would do it because I think as much as he's trying to convince other people that it would be great for you to lose even this, if you stepped up to be the superhero they need, I think deep down he knows whoever does this would absolutely be debasing themselves.
I think he does not have that consciousness.
Really? I mean, so, he's sure
he's an
played
insane
it.
Person.
I don't think I've ever seen someone like ask for someone to run for an election and put all these caveats of how it won't really hurt you if you lose. That's not really what you do if you want to win someone over to run for a particular, position. But, you know, who knows? He's a weird guy, so you could be right. All right, folks. Sam Cedar will be back here tomorrow on the Majority Report. Matt Leck, Brendan Sutton, and myself, Matt Binder. It was a pleasure to be with you all like we are every Thursday. And see you all next time.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught. See the truth in the light bulb. Finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the mental choice is made. For the option where you don't get paid. For the rope that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive.